No complaints.
Raced upstairs and got a cup.
I know. I said, what do they say? Life, stay awake for whatever. Yeah, the caribou.
Short,
the
yeah,
caribou.
Short, stay awake.
Yeah, life yeah. Short, stay awake. That's it.
No, I'm sorry. Good afternoon to all of you. It's 1 o'clock or a little bit after. Welcome to the meeting of the Environmental Quality Board. It's a delight to be here in Rochester this morning or this afternoon in this wonderful building. I had a chance to. I am a Norwegian, so I haven't had my gallon of coffee yet this morning. So I raced upstairs to the break room and found a coffee pot, and I'm loaded up and ready to go. So again, it's great to be here in Rochester, and it's kind of nice to be out of the Twin Cities, particularly when the legislature is in session. So I shouldn't have said that. You have in front of you, members of the board, a copy of the agenda, and the first item of business would be to adopt the consent agenda, which includes the agenda and the meeting of the February board minutes, rather. Is there a motion?
I move. So moved.
There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. At this point, I'd like to ask for introductions, and if we could start on my left, your right, John.
Hi, I'm John Saxhaug. I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Hello, I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner, Department of Transportation.
Kristen Ivy-Tollison, a citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Mike Rothman, the Commissioner of Commerce.
Will Seifert, Director of Environmental Quality Board.
And I'm Dave Fredrickson, the Commissioner of Agriculture and Chair of the EQB.
My name is Leah Hedman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I advise the board on legal issues.
My name is John Stein. I'm the Commissioner of Pollution Control Agency.
I'm Julie Gannon, citizen member from Moorhead.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Napstad. I'm the Chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you. At this time, I would like to just make a few comments about hopefully the way that the meeting will proceed here today. From my perspective, obviously this is an opportunity for the board to present and for the EQB to present their findings, the tools to assist local governments in planning and regulating silica sand projects, a requirement that was put to the board by the legislature, and we are completing that responsibility at this time. I would also encourage you all to, if you have comments that you would like to make, please fill out the card. I believe there were purple cards. And if, you know, certainly you can pick one up at any time during the course of the presentations by members of the staff, and please get them to me so that you have an opportunity to be heard here today. The process will go, I will ask for a motion to approve, I will ask for a second, and then we'll open up for discussion. I'm going to ask the members of the staff that have done the hard lift on this project to do presentations similar to what we've done in the past. And then when that is completed, they'll ask for public comment. And I'm hoping that we will be completed here by 4 o'clock. We have to make sure that several members have to be back in front of committees yet this late afternoon, so hopefully we can abide by the 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock timeline. Also, I'm told that for those of you that have parked out in the pay for parking area, the parking meters, that the office said that if you receive a ticket, to bring the ticket in, they will handle it from there, because it's difficult to have a 90-minute parking meter and we have a 3-hour meeting. So thank you to the City of Rochester for accommodating that. So if you know what to do with the parking ticket. Here's our guy, Commissioner Landry. He was worried about getting a parking ticket, so he drove, I think, to Orinoco to park or something.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful there. So Tom Landwehr is here now and joins us. Tom, I do that because we've already made the introduction. So I believe we are fully assembled. At this time, I'd like to ask Executive Director Will Seifert to make some comments before we move into the discussion item.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A brief couple of comments before we get going. Document availability. The document is available online. Because it's almost 200 pages, we did not print enough to accommodate the crowd we expected. So there are a limited number of copies available for folks who might have limitations to accessing this online. And so if you need a hard copy, please see Caroline. There's a couple comments. That, you know, the process of developing this report began in October. Included public meetings, comment periods, and local government surveys. I just want to thank those who participated in this process, citizens, industry, local officials. Your input was thoughtful, it was meaningful, and it really helped shape the document. Many of you have had to travel extensively and volunteer countless hours to participate in this dialogue. Your commitment is sincerely appreciated. Thank you to the staff who worked hard to put this document together. We hope that it proves useful to local government as they address silica sand-related issues going forward. We acknowledge that this document does not address every issue that has been raised during this process. It wasn't designed to. This is one piece of a bigger puzzle and part of an ongoing relationship with state and local governments. Development of the standards is part of a multi-pronged approach for addressing silica sand mining operations in Minnesota. This is outlined in the document and will be further discussed during the presentation. Through technical assistance teams, the Ordnance Library, Rulemaking, and Environmental Review, the EQB will continue its involvement in this issue through other avenues and will undoubtedly address issues not considered in this document and issues in need of further guidance. We hope that this level of public involvement continues with our other projects. It's been very helpful to staff and has improved our work. Briefly about our next meeting, April, just a note to members, this was, as we have discussed before, has been rescheduled to April 24. Just want you to note the scheduling change. The agenda for the April meeting is going to focus on a number of interagency water initiatives. So it should be a really interesting meeting, and we expect to carry that forward into May. So as we're planning these agendas, certainly open to suggestions as we make final decisions about that. So that's all.
All right. And again, the document that maybe some of you have in front of you or have looked at, it's been organized into sections or chapters based on very specific topics: air quality, water quality, and quantity, transportation, operations, setback considerations, and staff from the agencies that have been involved in this process will provide summaries of the topics by agency staff, and they're here with us today. So at this point in time, in order to get the document in front of us, I would ask for a motion to approve.
So moved.
There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second, and now for the discussion. So I'll ask Jeff. Jeff Schmeiser, I believe, will come up and lead off. Thank you, Jeff. Is that mic on?
I'll try to talk a little louder.
All right.
I'd like to thank the City of Rochester and Olmsted County for letting us use this room. What a great facility, huh? Jealous.
Beautiful.
This is really, really nice. It's really nice that everybody can see the screen. Your folks are seeing exactly what everybody else is seeing. It's not distorted like ours usually are, so that's really great. I'm going to talk about the document here and the process. Sort of starting out, just a review of why are we here. Recall the Minnesota Legislature did amend our statute 116C by adding the requirement that the DEP should develop model standards and criteria for mining, processing, and transporting silicon to consult with local units of government. The purpose of this document is that it may be used by local units of government in developing local ordinances, and the models need to reflect the differences in the different geographic areas of the state. So the process, which the executive director went through a bit, started out with public comments on September 18th at the board meeting. We opened a public comment period between October 18th and November 12th. We had public meetings in Mankato on October 25th and on October 29th, two meetings, one in St. Charles, one in Wabasha. We released a draft document on December 13th, which opened the next public comment period, which started out as 30 days, and in response to comments and requests from a number of people, we extended it an additional 2 weeks to go to January 27th. And in within that, we did take public comments at EQB subcommittee meeting on December 18th. Now we have the document that's being considered for approval today, and this is the cover of it. Just to sort of review the organization of this document, there are five chapters, as well as an introduction. There they are. Air quality, water quantity and quality, transportation, operations, and then setbacks and buffers. Within each one of those sections, there the sections are broken up into basically four different subsections. The description of the concerns for silica sand projects, then it gets into the narrative description and background, really the meat of each subsection. A brief list of potential impacts, and either recommendations or standards or criteria or considerations or any combination of those in each subsection depending on what was being discussed. There is some variation which is within each of the sections depending on the topic and how it's being addressed. Basically, that is the structure of the document. Presentation today, I will summarize the introduction. Jeff Edmond of the Pollution Control Agency will talk about the air quality chapter or section. Teresa Haugen of the Pollution Control Agency will talk about water quantity and water quality. Dave Christensen of the Department of Transportation will talk about transportation issues. Heather Ahrens of the Department of Natural Resources will talk about the operations. And Melissa Dobrowski of the Department of Natural Resources and Bob Patton from the Department of Agriculture will talk about the setbacks and buffer considerations. So going right to the introduction, the introduction is, it has sort of two parts, A, background, and B, the geology background. Within the first part of the background, the document is presenting itself as a toolbox. The whole toolbox concept is really, really helpful to understand what the document is trying to do. It offers numerous tools. There are options. If you're going to decide what to build, when you decide what to build, decide what you want to build first, and then select the proper tools to do that. You don't just reach into a toolbox and start working on things. You need to know what you're going to build, and that's the approach of this. So, we recommend that people decide what the local governments want to do before they start using the tool. There are instructions for the use of the tools within the toolbox, and we recommend that everybody use tools properly. As many of you might recall, when you're a kid or when your kids get into your toolbox, And they start banging on things and screwing things up, and, you know, when they start hammering nails in with the butt end of your screwdriver, it doesn't really do anybody any good. It bends the nail, puts holes in it, puts dents in a piece of wood, damages the handle of the screwdriver, and maybe even hurts your hand. So using tools properly is very, very important. Each chapter does note that there are certain tools for different geographic areas, different regions. Sometimes it's the same tool recommended for both areas. Sometimes there's different tools recommended for the different areas depending on the topic. In the introduction, we note that the authority for regulating land use rests primarily with local government in Minnesota. Now, the ETB does support good land use planning, and official controls, ordinances, and such should support the planning. So we're recommending that people do their solid land use planning first, and then start selecting which official controls should be adopted, and these tools should be helpful in adopting those official controls. The tools document is not supposed to be a substitute for land use planning. There have been, in my experience as an urban regional planner, jurisdictions that just immediately want to adopt an ordinance or amend an ordinance, and that'll solve everything. We really recommend that local governments do their planning first, adopt their ordinances later, and that's really the way good planning should operate. This document is not supposed to be a substitute for good planning. A really important point is that this document does not represent legal advice or legal opinions. We recommend that local governments seek advice from their legal counsel regarding the use of the tools in this document and adopting or amending local official controls. We do not want to pretend like we are attorneys and giving advice on legal issues. We want to make that very, very clear. Another really important point is that local units of government are not required to adopt any elements of this document. The ETB and our member agencies are not enforcing or attempting to enforce any elements of this document as if they are duly adopted state rules. There are quite a number of comments that we received that were questioning whether we are following certain procedures that are required for adopting rules by state agencies. We are not adopting rules. None of the member agencies are adopting rules under the Administrative Procedures Act with this document. And we are not pretending to enforce them as if they are adopted state rules. That's something that we really want to make clear. Some of the things we added to this document from the December 13th draft. We give a summary of the technical assistance team that was required by statute, that the ETB create a technical assistance team to help local governments with technical issues. We, in this version of the document, summarize the ordinance and permit library that also was ordered by the legislature. And it's available online, and it is growing, and probably will continue to grow for a while. We are in the middle of a rulemaking process. Three different agencies, the Pollution Control Agency, Department of Natural Resources, and the Environmental Quality Board, are participating in an advisory panel process before we actually draft some rules, and that rulemaking process is ongoing. We've had two meetings. We will have the next one on April 7th, and those meetings are noticed on the Silica Sand website and the PCA website, so they are available. They're open to the public, but they're not public meetings per se. We're public giving comment. But we have a representation of citizenry, the mining industry, and local governments on that rulemaking panel. We also talk about local planning and zoning training and information that's available to local governments. This is a really important piece because there are associations. There's a township association, there's a county association, there's a municipality association that does offer land use planning and zoning training to their local government officials. We strongly recommend that local governments take advantage of those training opportunities. After all, if you're a member of those associations, you're paying for that already, take advantage of it to the greatest degree that you can, because that's really an important way to get advice on the particular topics. We also summarize the environmental review program. The environmental review program does offer a really great opportunity. Several opportunities are in the rules for collecting information on the potential for environmental effects of any particular project that's going on out there or is proposed. And I always, when I was, again, city planner, I actually did use the EAW worksheet very often, even when we weren't doing an EAW. In fact, when I rewrote the city's big chunks, the city's ordinance, and included a template for how staff is going to review individual development projects, I used the topics in the environmental assessment worksheet as a guide and designed a template for staff reports that included those topics in the EAW form. So I think environmental review can really, really be useful for collecting information on individual projects. And so we summarize the environmental review program in this new document. We added a little bit of the document on more copies of the statutes. The original document in December, we had the model standards and criteria. We added the part about environmental review rules of the rulemaking. We added the part about the ordinance and permit library. The environmental review additional categories that are created in the statute, then the library, and then the part of the law that requires the rulemaking that three different agencies. All those pieces of the statute and laws 2013 are now in the document. And as I said, the other half of the introduction is about the different geographic areas of the state. Sorry, I talked about geology, but really the different geographic areas of the state are characterized by the geology in those areas primarily, as well as some of the different natural resources that are there. And those are summarized in the introduction of the document. With that, I would like to turn it over to the head of the PCA, unless the board has any questions of me on the introduction or anything else.
Questions for Jeff? Seeing none, thank you, Jeff. And we'll move then to Jeff Hedman. Welcome, Jeff. And Jeff is going to visit the topic of air quality that's contained in the document. Jeff?
Again, I'll try to talk loudly. Good afternoon, Chair, Board members. Again, my name is Jeff Hedman, and I work in the MPCA's air permit section. I will present a bird's eye view of the air-related topics that are covered in the EQB's model standards and criteria document. The information in this section is the work of multiple state agencies, including the Department of Health, Natural Resources, Transportation, and the MPCA. This work was further refined after receiving comments in the draft December document. The first of these topics concerns air monitoring. The MPCA has an existing ambient monitoring network that collects data for a variety of pollutants, including various size fractions of particulate matter. However, the MPCA's ambient monitoring network is primarily designed to gather information about wide geographic areas. Certain facilities within the state have source-oriented, also known as fence line monitors, including refineries, sugar beet plants, and large manufacturing facilities. The pollutant of interest for this particular industry is called particulate matter, and is divided into several sizes of interest by a parameter known as aerodynamic diameter. This parameter is selected as it is associated with the degree to which the particle can penetrate the human lung. The smaller the particle, the deeper the penetration, and the greater the impact on human health. This industry works primarily with silica sand, which raises additional questions regarding the composition of the particulate matter that is emitted by these facilities. Silica has long been regulated by the federal government through the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the Mine Safety and Health Administration. These entities regulate within the property boundary of the facility. The US EPA, and by extension the MPCA, regulate what is known as ambient air. This term, ambient air, refers to the portion of the atmosphere external to buildings to which the general public has access. This is generally viewed as the fence line of the facility. At this time, there are very little silica ambient air data. In order to address the lack of data, state and local regulatory bodies have taken action. In Minnesota Department of Health has provided technical guidance in the form of a health-based value regarding chronic exposure to silica in ambient air. The MDH provided this guidance during the summer of 2013. In addition, the MPCA has inserted fence line monitoring requirements into newly issued air permits for silica sand facilities. Some counties, such as Scott County, have coordinated with the MPCA in order to develop monitoring requirements for silica sand facilities. If a local unit of government is interested in pursuing ambient air monitoring for a silica sand facility, then we encourage that local unit of government to start by reviewing the information provided within the ETB document. After reviewing it, we strongly recommend that they contact us in order to develop a site-specific air monitoring plan. For informational purposes, we have also included rough cost estimates. It is expected that the cost of monitoring will be borne by the facility in question. The guidance we provide within the ETB document speaks to the types of pollutants that should be monitored, how often to monitor, what types of monitors to use, the frequency at which monitors collect data, the silica analytical method that should be used, the citing criteria that should be evaluated, and how and who the data to which the data should be reported. After the plan is developed, it will include site-specific conditions, account for local meteorology, reference the equipment and analytical methods that will be used to measure particulate matter and crystalline silica concentration, and span a time period covering pre- and post-construction site conditions. The MPCA will host this data on its website. The next air-related topic concerns methods that can be used to control or prevent dust from leaving a silica sand facility. The primary way in which dust leaves the facility, the property of the facility, is through an interaction with wind. If this interaction is prevented or suppressed, then the particulate matter emissions will be reduced. Therefore, nearly all of the following recommendations stem from this idea. If a local unit of government is interested in using its local permit to limit the degree to which dust leaves the facility, then we encourage the local unit of government to start by reviewing the information in the ETB document. The ETB document describes a dust control strategy that addresses multiple facets of a silica sand process, up to and including the transportation of silica sand. We recommend that processing activities be enclosed and that the emissions from these processes be routed to filter-based dust control technology. We recognize that certain portions of a silica sand facility cannot be enclosed and make recommendations regarding these areas as well. For example, we recommend that mine haul roads be watered at a prescribed rate and suggest some record keeping and testing to ensure that the roads are watered to the degree specified. We make recommendations regarding the transportation of silica sand, including covered loads, a mechanism to wash trucks prior to leaving the facility, fleet composition, and record keeping of the vehicles and routes traveled. The third air-related topic concerns noise. Noise is regulated by the state by time of day and by the location of the person that hears the noise. In general, noise is regulated in a more stringent fashion for nighttime periods and for residential areas. If a local unit of government is interested in evaluating or requiring noise testing, then we recommend that the local unit of government review the information within the ETB document. Within the document, we recommend that every residence within a defined survey radius be checked both before and after construction of a silica sand facility. The survey radius was based on information collected by the National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety at numerous surface mines and dredge facilities. In the event that noise levels exceed state standards, then we recommend the facility raise berm heights, add vegetation, and perform subsequent testing. The final air-related topic concerns accumulation of silica sand within the transportation chain and includes some crossover with water-related issues. If a local unit of government is interested in measures that could be taken to contain the effects of temporary storage pile, then we encourage the local unit of government to review the information within the ETB document. Silica sand facilities routinely store sand prior to shipping out by truck, rail, or barge. As was mentioned in the dust control section of the ETB document, we recommend that the routine or in-process storage pile be enclosed in order to prevent material from leaving the site. In the event that supply and demand creates a situation where an open-air one-time storage is needed, then the material should be watered at a prescribed rate. The storage pile should be located such that it avoids surface and stormwater conveyances such as curbs, gutters, and ditches. Once the temporary pile has been removed, the area should be vacuum swept as soon as possible. As I mentioned earlier, the ETB received comment on each of these four topics during the comment period. The ETB and associated state agencies reviewed the comments and took the opportunity to add revisions and clarifications to the air section. I'd like to give you a brief overview of some of the changes that were made to the air section. First, a short section on ultrafine particles was added. As the document now indicates, ultrafine particles were considered during USEPA's most recent review of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for particulate matter. At that time, the USEPA concluded that it did not have enough information to make a causal link between aerosol effects, but at the same time, it could not rule it out either. In order to assist the USEPA, the MPCA will take the first step in Minnesota by installing and operating an ultrafine particle monitor near one of the busiest stretches of road, the interchange between I-94 and I-35. On a related note, the document now emphasizes that the current air-related standards and efficiencies referenced throughout the section use mass as a basis. Recent studies suggest that mass may not be the best method for characterizing these very small or ultrafine particles. Again, these types of particles are being reviewed at the federal level by USEPA. The section now provides some additional details on the quality assurance and quality control procedures that are necessary in order to produce reliable data that regulators use in order to make informed decisions. The document now recommends that the fugitive dust control strategy be memorialized within a document called the Fugitive Dust Control Plan. These plans enable the facility, the regulator, and the public to understand what is expected at a particular site. The document now includes a short description of a type of monitor called a baghouse leak detector. These detectors can provide additional information regarding the relative increase in emissions from certain stacks, provided the airflow also meets certain criteria. The document now provides additional details regarding federal regulation of on-road and off-road engines, and includes a discussion of certain model years and tier ratings associated to these engines. Finally, the document now provides additional supporting information regarding dust control and moisture content. This concludes the overview of the air-related topics. Assuming you have no further questions, we'll ask
them. Are there questions from any of the members? If not, thank you very much, Jeff. And I think Teresa Haugen will present on water quality and water quantity. Welcome, Teresa. Thanks for your hard work.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the Board. I'm Teresa Haugen and work in the Water Quality Permit Section of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The next section of the EQD Tools document covers the water quantity and water quality model standards and criteria. The water section of the document is the work of multiple state agencies and staff, including the Department of Health, Department of Natural Resources, and the MPCA. The following five slides present a high-level overview of the contents in the water section, including changes that were made between the draft that was published on December 13th and the version that was released on March 7th. The first part of the water section of the tools document, water quantity, deals with the amount of water used for the allocation and controls of waters of the state. Waters of the state meaning both groundwater and surface waters. The DNR administers these water use or appropriation permits prior to commencement of any SOCA sand operation that wants to use more than 10,000 gallons of water per day or 1 million gallons per year for activities such as dewatering, washing, and transporting sand. As part of a water appropriation permit application for SOCA sand activities, the following is included: a domestic well inventory, wetland delineation, hydrogeologic investigation, aquifer tests, groundwater computer model, and proposed monitoring. If there are any concerns regarding water use in SOCA sand operations, the local unit of government should work with the DNR to provide comments during the water appropriation permit application period. Local units of government can also work with DNR, MPCA, and the Department of Health to help establish a detailed monitoring network. If any problems arise with SOCA sand operations and water use, such as domestic well interference or water use conflict, DNR can work with local units of government to ensure mitigation plans. The next part of the water section of the tools document focuses on water quality, starting with groundwater, and gives suggestions to aid in protecting it. If there are concerns regarding SOCA sand activities and groundwater contamination, it is recommended that thorough site characterization and monitoring occur. The site characterization should include a hydrogeological study to ensure that the interactions with geologic materials and processes with water, especially groundwater, are well understood, and any special features or conditions, such as karst formations and sinkholes, are identified. A site-specific groundwater monitoring network should then be established to provide sufficient information to evaluate water quality upgrading and downgrading of the project site. Careful tailoring of site-specific monitoring well network should occur to ensure that any complex hydrogeology, such as that found in karst areas of the state, is adequately addressed and accounted for so that groundwater and surface waters are protected. Through these monitoring well networks, sample and analysis of groundwater for any analytes of concern should occur. There is a list of recommended analytes included in the document that the LGU may choose from if they desire. The analytes selected will likely vary depending on the hydrogeologic settings and site operations. It is recommended that sampling occur pre-construction to set a baseline for natural background conditions, and that sampling continue to occur throughout the life of the silica sand site and continue post-reclamation to help ensure groundwater and surface waters are not negatively impacted. In addition, silica sand project proposers should complete a well inventory, follow proper well sealing protocol, and notify the local unit of government and Department of Health when sealing occurs. Furthermore, it is recommended that on at least an annual basis, silica sand facilities should submit sampling and analysis results to the local governmental unit and mitigate as requested by the local government unit if signs of contamination are found. LGUs can request more frequent submittal intervals if they desire. The next part of the water scanner section of the document focuses on surface water quality and its protection. If there are concerns with silica sand operations contaminating surface water, then there are recommendations that can be put into place, including best management practices and monitoring. For instance, if there are dewatering, processed wastewaters, and or stormwater discharges to surface water, then monitoring these discharges is recommended. In addition, sampling and analysis of receiving surface water should occur. Pre-construction monitoring of receiving surface waters to establish a baseline for natural background conditions is recommended. Monitoring of receiving water should continue throughout the life of silica sand operation and following reclamation to help ensure no negative impacts to surface waters occur. Additionally, proper wastewater basin construction and management should be required to prevent unintended discharges to waters in the state. Furthermore, if chemical additives such as polyacrylamide flocculants are to be used, then there are precautions for their use included in this portion of the document. Again, on at least an annual basis, silica sand facilities should submit sampling and analysis results to the local unit of government to mitigate if signs of contamination are found. The last piece of the water standard section, the TULA document, covers stormwater, chemical containment, and temporary storage of sand. There's concern about stormwater, chemicals, and or temporary stockpiles contaminating waters in the state and causing nuisance conditions on neighboring properties. Then proper stormwater management, runoff rate, and volume control, along with proper pond design, is recommended. Stormwater should be managed in a manner in which the stormwater is contained on site so that the pre-construction and post-construction runoff rate and volume are not different for a 100-year 24-hour storm event. Ponds or stormwater control basins should be properly designed and managed so that unintended discharges do not occur. And all chemicals used in silica sand operations should be properly stored and managed, including secondary containment to prevent spills, leaks, and other discharges to waters in the state. In addition, precautions to prevent contamination of stormwater runoff with chemicals and or significant materials are recommended, including waste sediment that contains flocculants. And silica sand stored on a temporary basis should be enclosed to protect waters in the state. When enclosure is not entirely possible, the storage pile should be located and managed in an area that will not negatively impact groundwater and surface waters. For example, temporary storage piles should not be placed in surface water or stormwater conveyance areas such as curbs, gutters, and ditches. The last slide discusses changes made to the water section of the document. Changes made to the document were based off public comment and internal review and mainly reflect clarifications or additional detail or overall minor in nature. Some of the changes to the water section include clarifying details on the geological description for the Paleozoic Plateau and Minnesota River Valley. Stronger language was included, acknowledging that karst features may be present in the Minnesota River Valley and that it's not as well studied as the Paleozoic Plateau. Also, the document now makes mention of the Tacora Edge and its respective edge support areas, and that these aquifer recharge and filtration zone areas should be analyzed carefully. There's further background information on flocculants and their use in the industrial silica sand process. Language discussing the potential for contaminated stormwater run-on entering the site and its impacts on water quality has been added to the document. And also, language was added to further support that some of the recommendations of the water quality portion of the document may or may not be included in a state permit, and that LGUs can contact state agencies with any questions on what a state permit is required and what may or may not be covered in a state permit. And finally, the LGU survey results are now included. These survey results give additional detail on how the LGUs that responded to the survey currently regulate water quality-related concerns, for example, at the state level or the local level. This will conclude the overview of the water section. Again, the water-related material just described with much further detail can be found on pages 43 to 75 of this document.
Thank you very much, Teresa. Are there questions from members of the board? Kristen?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Howden, you mentioned engaging LGUs in permit comments.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit more about, it's confusing, about what state, what global, how do you see that happening, this procedure?
There are certain requirements that state agencies put into their permits as they're charged to do through Minnesota state rule. So I would recommend in the forefront of regulating a project that they contact state agencies to figure out what is covered in a state permit and what isn't, because it can be confusing.
And then they would comment to the state in a permit proceeding? Is that what you're anticipating? Okay. It was on your PowerPoint.
Was it in the water quality portion?
Yeah.
Okay. That question would be best answered by the actual resources.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Having worked there before. Having administered the program. Sorry. I think the DNR's permitting requirement under law is that they accept comments from local units of government on water appropriation and work in public waters permits. So under the law, soil and water conservation districts and the responsible governmental unit for zoning, so it might be the county or the city, has a standing to provide comments within a specified period of time to DNR on their permits.
That's
so
standard.
It's probably written because of that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, other questions from members of the board? Seeing none, thank you very much. And I'd like to ask Dave Christensen from MnDOT to come up and present on transportation issues. Welcome, Dave. Thanks again for your work on this project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'd like to reference the comments and changes in the transportation section on the fact that transportation is addressed in terms of dust suppression, diesel vehicle emissions, and other matters having to do that are site-specific to the operation in other sections, such as the air quality and operations sections. We've dovetailed quite a bit and provided input for those. Transportation in particular is characterized by the fact that unlike a site for quarrying sand or for processing sand or transloading sand, there is a large area of corridor impact in transporting sand, particularly by truck over long distances. This has an impact basically because of the intensive use of the designated route and its alternatives, and the major impacts in particular, not so much on state federal roads, but on light duty rural roads that are designed with an intent for a shorter life and a lighter duty that can be destroyed in a matter of years and sometimes months under the impact of heavy commercial trucks. One thing that we did respond to based on public comments as well as comments on the interagency group and from elected officials at the local, state, and federal level and regulators is that we clarified and expanded the comments on transportation stewardship, that is, the role of each government unit as a road authority to provide public access and full use of public roads, and in the case of state federal governments, the licensed common carriers for the transport of free transport of both people and their property. But that is balanced very clearly in precedent and law with planning authorities, land use planning, and local police powers. And we pointed directly at references that help to illustrate that. The court recommends, as in other areas, that professional advice be asked for from the various parties that have expertise in that area. The responses to what we designed into this for the local government unit to use was, of course, a traffic impact study, and we expanded that as well. Talk a little bit more about that. A road use maintenance agreement, which is basically a private negotiated document that can be required for a conditional use permit and safety accommodations. On the route assessments, we had talked about how the LGUs along the route should be involved in evaluation of the route. We expanded that to talk about not only the routes, but route alternatives, detours, and other areas that trucks might be traveling in the case of, for instance, maintenance on the main route. And that this assessment and, of course, the monitoring of the road conditions and the compensation agreements to pay for road use and wear and tear be shared by all LGUs along the route. This is something that's not required by state law, but it's proven to be a major deficiency in areas like Iowa and Wisconsin that have major sand operations already, where a permitting unit can receive compensation for their road wear, but the road authorities that have trucks traveling through their area are not party to the agreements and the licensing and the compensation, and therefore are stuck with having to pay for road use that they don't have any control over. So this is a recommended best management practice. We talked about using the state-provided load and life calculators for road use. So it would be a technical evaluation of what the costs are in the road, and to always negotiate a road use and maintenance agreement. This is already used all over the country in neighboring states and states that are facing frac sand production as well as shale oil production. And that road use maintenance agreement, again, talks to all the aspects of the cost, the deterioration, the use, and the compensation for that road use as a private agreement between the parties. For mutual benefit, obviously a sand producer or operator cannot use the roads if they've been destroyed. And there's no requirement for a local government unit to correct that problem to the stage where heavy commercial trucks can have use of it again if that happens. We're talking about heavy commercial trucks that in Minnesota are loaded to a legal 80,000 pound load, as opposed to a local automobile that might be a 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 pound vehicle and basically produces nowhere on the road. 95% of all road wear is produced by heavy commercial trucks. The traffic impact study is recommended to be done by the local government unit in cooperation with the applicant, hopefully paid for by the applicant, that again is recommended, and to study the full length of the route. One of the things that we recommend be added to that is that not only the technical aspects of road wear be included in that traffic impact study and safety measures, things of that sort, but also recognition, at least in commentary and discussion and negotiation, of the impacts on local economic effects, such as tourism and recreation in the area. So that the road routing and the compensation and the design of the roads and mitigation takes consideration of that as well. Safety accommodations, of course, are very important. Safety is job one for MnDOT, most local road authorities. And we note that there are specific conflicts, particularly in southeast Minnesota, in Amish communities and in recreational areas, where there is a direct and unsafe conflict being created in situations like this between heavy commercial trucks and other non-vehicular or non-motorized users of the road. And so we're talking about utilizing best practices to mitigate that, particularly wide shoulders, turn lanes, better signage, education programs, and reduced speeds. Again, examples of where conflict occurs, deadly conflicts in some instances. And then, of course, scenic byways and trails. MnDOT back in the 1970s was party to creating a system of easements that protect scenic views, for instance, from Highway 61 to the top of the Mississippi River Bluffs are generally preserved by MnDOT easements. There are other easements along trails, scenic byways, archaeological sites, and all over the state with different agencies that are protected. And we recommend, again, and provide resources through MnDOT and the other agencies to research that and require that in the conditional permitting process. These are just some of the byways that we have around the state and some of the agencies and trails that are involved. Obviously something very important and a tool that local government should be aware of. Mr. Chair, that ends my presentation.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Christensen? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. Heather Ahrens, on the operations aspect. Heather is here from the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you very much, Heather.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Heather Ahrens. I work for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources as a geologist. I coordinated the operations section, which includes six parts: information about lighting, hours of operation, reclamation, financial assurance, blasting and blast plans, and inspections. Much of the structure and content of the document didn't change between the draft. It still includes information about clarifying jurisdiction between local, state, and federal governments. In Minnesota, we kind of have an integrated approach to non-metallic mining, where the LGUs are responsible for the permit to mine. The state does have permitting authority, for example, waters, air. In some areas, I expanded upon this jurisdiction to specify and to bring out what federal regulations might apply as well. In general, there are roughly approximately 55 comment letters that were submitted, and that was a rough count. 20 of them had comments related to the operations section and or geological portion. The operation that did add contextual language about environmental review as in how it plays with permitting. Because LGUs are mostly responsible for the various subtopics of this section, environmental review plays a large role in informing the decisions that people or LGUs need to put in their potential local permit. Lighting. The jurisdiction with lighting is at the federal level is with MSHA and OSHA. The state also has MnOSHA, which is rules 5205 associated with it. The specifications are actually very broad, more performance standards in terms of MSHA. They basically specify that lighting needs to be adequate to the safety of the line worker. The concern with lighting in silica sand is that it will produce light emissions and contribute to ambient light pollution. Although this is a regional issue, environmental problem with many tissue resources, like residential developments, commercial parking lots. But the concern for silica sand is that it will that light emanating from silica sand project would further contribute to night sky and change the character of the community. In this process, I consulted with the MnDOT lighting engineer, Sue Garland. Since the release of the draft, I also looked into additional information and spoke to Sue. She got in contact with the Illumination Engineer Society, which is an authoritative organization for producing light standards, and confirmed that there were no additional standards associated with mining. I also touched base with MSHA about their light requirements, and like I said, it's a performance standard, which was incorporated to the document. I received about 4 comments, as well as seeking input from MnDOT, and there are a lot of comments about safety and visibility of the forest concerning safety. So I added language to put in the context the role of lighting in terms of safety for nighttime workers. Overall, the recommendations didn't change. If the community is interested in reducing light emissions, it's recommended that they adopt lighting ordinances that would apply to all sources of light. I gave reference to a model ordinance that was produced by the Illumination Engineer Society and the International Dark Sky Association, as well as a reference to Green Step Cities Program, which is a program through PCA that can help communities reduce light emissions. In terms of a local permit, an LGU can specify creating photometric plans as a condition of a local permit, and such things that they can require no light emissions above 90 degrees. Also, I integrated a component of size into the recommendation. For example, if there are large areas or if there's a large lifespan of a mine that would require illumination, that maybe that those were applicable places to require more stringent lighting controls. Hours of operation, for the most part, most silica sand activities are regulated by the LGU. The setting of hours of operation is determined at the local level. Hours of operation do not change significantly. In creating the section, I relied heavily upon practices that are currently administered by LGUs. Again, there are 2 ways to implement hours of operation, through ordinance or through the permit. I recommend that LGUs consider information generated from the environmental reviews, such as traffic and noise studies, to guide decisions and implement site-specific conditions through local permitting. The review of the conditions of the site is how it fits into the surrounding land uses, what would be a best approach in determining hours. There are a few options that are available to LGUs. Examples are a restrictive hours of operation where they say you can operate from 7 to 6 or 7 to 7. An example of it's non-restrictive is where an operation can be go 24/7. And then there's somewhere in between where you might specify by activity. For example, if there's construction berms or activities near the property line, you might want to have a different hours of operation than, say, if there's a mine site far away from a different property boundary. Comments that I received were concerned about the unintended consequences of limiting hours, and this was addressed in the text of the document. Some of the consequences are how it might affect truckers that are associated, independent truckers that are associated with the mining operation. The third section, reclamation, again, is regulated and enforced by the LGU and based on the permitting of individual sites. Information in this document includes types of things you should consider in a reclamation plan, mine plan design, and other considerations. The objective was to outline information, and unfortunately not be a forum or an extensive guidebook. I got a lot of comments with reclamation from a wide range of topics, and I really got a sense that people did want this to be a guidebook of sorts for how to reclaim or how to implement reclamation. Guidebooks tend to be 160 pages within themselves. As a result, though, I did reference 3 excellent guidebooks, one produced by the DNR for reclaiming sand and gravel pits, one produced by the Alberta of Canada for reclaiming quarries, and then Wisconsin actually has some non-metallic reclamation guidebooks that also are being implemented for silica sand as well. So I added added language about how to use test blocks and how well to determine a reclamation plan, tree jet regeneration standards. Most notable addition to reclamation was a subsection of underground mining. The first draft did not mention underground mining. This section includes a recommendation of requiring a discretionary EIW and hiring a mining engineer at the cost of a project appraiser. This is just one example that I mentioned of using my expertise through environmental review that at the cost of the proposer to assist LGBs through this information. I outlined some information that LGBs should think about when a proposal for an underground mine may be brought to them. Once again, it's not exhaustive, and I would highly recommend consulting an engineer, but did outline some things like how that the proposer should identify a pillar load strength to make sure that you know, it's able to hold the substrate above, detailed map of tunnels for potential emergency response efforts, and items like that. Overall, with effective mine planning combined with suffers and setbacks and buffers, issues related to noise, dust, and visual impact have the potential to be reduced. This is an example of a mine plan included in the document, and you know, instead of having a windy road versus a straight road, we can reduce visual impacts. Removing your stockpile and placing it immediately is another way to do phased reclamation. Inclusion of a fence to protect public safety. Those are just some examples of some of the recommendations that are in the document. I received some questions if mines were ever successfully reclaimed in Minnesota. So I decided to include two examples of reclaimed mines here, but the one that I included specifically in the document is the picture on the right. This is a reclaimed gravel pit that's in the city of Rochester, the Foster Aaron's Park. It's a swimming pool in an area that's devoid of natural lakes, and the facility includes handicapped accessible fishing pier, railroad trolley dock, as well as being built large home baths. The picture to the left is in the Minnesota River Valley, and this is a reclaimed silica sand mine. On the right of the picture where there's the rock piles, that is a reclaimed sand pit that used to be a large pit and has been backfilled. In terms of reclamation, the topography is graded, the slopes are stabilized, and the area has been planted with native local prairie. The site is covered, so the goal was to have a potential habitat site and wildlife site. And other than maintenance, this is a reclaimed, prescribed maintenance for prescribed bird for prairie. This is a stable site and a reclaimed site for mining. The fourth section is financial assurance. This is also implemented by the LGUs. I received some comments, some of them were positive. So financial assurance is a function of a reclamation plan, a mine plan, as well as inspections. All those things go hand in hand. The state developed a few years ago tools for LGUs that regulate solid waste facilities, and which include financial assurance mechanisms, what they are, language and contract language, and I cited those. This was developed by PCA through rulemaking and through the Administrative Procedure Act. The section includes information of what to consider when calculating financial assurance, as well as recommendations of managing financial assurance. Such things like removal of buildings, grading and costs and topsoil costs, things that you would have to think about to reclaim a site if for some reason an operator were to abandon that site. Uh,
fifth section is blasting and blasting. Now there's concern, blasting is a controlled use of explosives to excavate or remove rock. Depending on how well sandstone is cemented, blasting might occur through mining, or it may not. Obvious concerns related to blasting include the vibrations through air and ground and associated with the shock waves that's produced by blasting. Environmental concerns include the release of nitrates and other chemicals. Blasting compounds are composed of ammonium nitrate fuel oil, some emulsions, which is generally a gel to prevent and contain nitrate to be used in underwater, well, whether it's water in a blast hole, may contain polyacrylamide. However, the use and production of acrylamide is used across many industries, and at this point it's difficult to discern a source. There is, in the original draft document, there was a misplaced decimal point in the standard related to vibration thresholds for historical structures. To resolve this issue, I looked at guidance documents for road and bridge construction. It is common across within the U.S. and internationally to have special precautions for historical structures. The American State Highway and Transportation officials, as well as MnDOT, have developed blasting thresholds for structures, which I cited. A couple of things that are important to note. Blasting for mining tends to not travel as far as blasting for road construction. And then ASHTO also suggested that taking a cautious approach and setting vibration limits and to allow some case-by-case flexibility. As far as legislation, and I think this is very important to note, is that although Minnesota is not regulated through the federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation Enforcement. And then as far as the state only regulates blasting in terms of iron mining and non-ferrous mining. So it's up to LGUs to regulate blasting. We're one of a handful of states across the U.S. But with that said, the federal government has very well-established blasting regulations that have been developed over the last 100 years associated with coal mining. This document gives information and standards that are used as federal guidelines. And then it's important to note, just like lighting, if you produce a blasting standard that you're implying to the sand, the standard would also apply to other activities such as blasting for road construction in your jurisdiction. Finally, inspections. This is also regulated and enforced by LGUs. It is up to the purview of LGUs to enforce the conditions of their permit. Inspections are an integral component of reclamation and financial insurance. This document outlines considerations for pre-inspection of a mine site inspection, post-inspection of a mine site, which was developed by the California Surface Mining and Reclamation Act. I didn't really see very many comments, but it added language about underground mining associated with inspections. For surface mining, the information produced by in California is geared for slightly technical people with a background to be able to go in and inspect. However, with underground mining, my recommendation is to have a mining engineer do inspections related to that. And at this point, I conclude my section, and we'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Tom?
Mr. Chair, just maybe a clarification. Heather, how do the rules on reclamation that the department is working on relate to the model standards?
Thank you. We are in the process of creating rules for reclamation of silica sand projects, and this information will help inform the rulemaking process along with public comment and input from an advisory panel. And so while this is not necessarily what's going to be developed in rule, but this information will be used in the development.
Mr. Chair, Heather, so to be clear, when the rules are finalized, they will then guide reclamation and the model ordinances will be sort of supported.
That's exactly right.
Further questions? If not, thank you very much, Heather. At this time, I'd like to ask Melissa Dobrowski and Bob Patton to come up and present on setback considerations. Thank you both. Nice tie, Bob Patton. You're just a trendsetter on neckties, I tell you. It's tough to compete with.
Oh.
Welcome.
Well, I'd like you to tie it to it as well.
I'm good at not going to comment on it.
Yeah,
right. No. Please.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair, members, and folks in the audience. I'm Melissa Dobrowski with the Department of Natural Resources, and my colleague,
Bob Daphne, with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
And we are going to kind of be tag-teaming this conversation for you guys. Okay, so we're here to talk about, we're here to talk to you about Section 8 responsive considerations for setbacks and buffers. Our presentation, similarly to the preceding presentation, is going to be a broad overview of what is covered in this section, which highlights on what changes were made in the final document, along with a brief discussion on comments that were received during the December-January public comment period. This section, Considerations for Setbacks and Buffers, is comprised of a background and introduction and 11 subsection topics. First, we're going to take a few minutes to discuss the background and introduction part of this section. The background and introduction provides a discussion on the definition of setbacks and buffers as used in this document, how they may be used to reduce impacts to surrounding land uses and general considerations for LPUs in the application of setbacks and or buffers. LPUs and readers will note that this part of the section has largely been rewritten for the final document. However, the discussion, overall theme, and intent of this part of the section remain very similar to the draft document. Several comments were received during the public comment period that indicated that as it was written, the discussion lacked some clarity and details on considerations. These changes were made to accommodate those comments. As previously mentioned, the revised background and introduction provides more details specific to the history and application of setbacks and buffers, how they work, and considerations in their applications, such as landowner rights, the details of a specific proposed project, and the individual community's resources, values, and goals.
Mr. Chair, board members, and members of the audience, I'm going to cover the background and introduction part of this chapter, starting with the setbacks. As Ms. Dobrowski mentioned, we wanted to provide additional clarity. That was the thrust of a lot of the comments we received. We started with the definitions, and the revised definition, in addition to just cleaning up some language, one of the things it does, it clarifies the type of setback we're talking about here. Setbacks are used for all sorts of purposes. It's a very old tool in zoning. The type of setback we're talking about here is specifically for the purpose of reducing the impacts resulting from the proposed land use, which in this case is silica sand projects. We also have kind of a mini definition embedded in this definition of land use, really specifying that when we talk about land use, we're talking about human uses of land as opposed to natural features of the landscape, and you'll see use of that later on here. As far as buffers, the buffer definition remained mostly the same, but again, clarified that the purpose of the buffer was specifically to reduce impacts of a proposed land use upon adjacent land uses or natural features. In addition to providing clarity in this document, we also, particularly in the introductory section, wanted to address comments we received that the prior draft was a little bit negative towards setbacks, or it discouraged their use, where setbacks are actually a very familiar and available tool for local governments and can be effective. And so to address that, as Ms. Dabrowski covered, the structure of the introductory section is to talk about how setbacks work and then talk about considerations of their use and buffers as well. So I'm going to overview that part. We talk about how setbacks work, which is really a basic idea that impacts, whether they're light, noise, air impacts, water impacts, they share a characteristic of diminishing with distance. And so, as illustrated in these two illustrations that are also in the document, by increasing the distance, you can effectively reduce the impacts that are experienced by the receiving land use, the surrounding land use. Now, there are some complicating factors, however, that need to be recognized. For one thing, not all projects are the same. They vary in intensity of the generation of those impacts at the source. And so, obviously, that affects the impacts that are received by the surrounding land uses. Additionally, atmospheric conditions, wind particularly, can really change the experience of impacts for the receiving property, for the surrounding land use. Terrain, topography, structures also can block light and sound. They can modify the air currents. And so change the experience of impacts for the surrounding land uses. Water, just the nature of water, what features exist, what the flow, the groundwater and surface water flow, that will change how water impacts are experienced by landing, by surrounding land uses. All this together means that the ability of setbacks to mitigate impacts of a project are really dependent on characteristics of the project itself, on the surrounding, the land that the project is on, and the surrounding land uses and environment, which makes it particularly tricky to establish setbacks that apply to all land uses within a zoning district or across a jurisdiction. And so that's one of the cautions that we have in the document about establishing setbacks and buffers within ordinances. We recognize, however, that may be very desirable to do that. And one of the recommendations we make is when setbacks and buffers are established in ordinance, that there is some adjustment allowed when at the time of project approval, that those can be adjusted when the conditions of the project itself and the site and the surrounding environment are known through the environmental review and review process. In establishing any land use requirement, really, including setbacks, it's a local government responsibility to do so, and it's always a balance between the benefits of establishing the protective abilities of that setback or buffer and the effect of the setback, particularly on the land use, on the regulated land use. And so we have some graphics and also a table in the document that describe the effect of a setback, in this case, setbacks established from property lines, on the amount of land available to be developed. These graphics show a 160-acre parcel or quarter section parcel. That shows the effect of a 100-foot setback, a 500-foot setback, a and then a 1,000-foot setback on the developable area. And then we have a graphic showing the effect of 1,000-foot setbacks around dwellings on developable area for a 160-acre parcel. We do recommend that setbacks or suggest that setbacks established from property lines provide the most consistent separation between land uses. We do, however, suggest that you can also establish a combination of property line and property line setbacks and setbacks around land use features such as residences to accommodate for situations, particularly where you might have some residences that are unusually close to the property line, having that additional layer of a setback around the residence is helpful. In contrast to establishing setbacks for protecting residential uses, when you're dealing with natural features such as a river, it makes most sense to establish that setback in the feature itself. In terms of buffers, this graphic shows a vegetative buffer. We talk about the differences between uses of vegetative and hard buffers like walls and berms. Vegetative buffers are helpful in terms of just providing screening, some aesthetic screening from uses. Really aren't terribly effective for blocking light or sound, and also not terribly effective for air quality impacts. A hard buffer like a wall or a berm can be more effective for blocking light and sound, not so effective for air quality impacts. For water, the term buffer is used for buffers that are used in watersheds, such as a shoreline buffer. It's really a different type of buffer altogether, because when you're talking about a buffer for water quality, you're generally talking about grass or another low-growing vegetative type of buffer that will trap nutrients as water flows through it, slow down the velocity of the water to allow particulates to drop out. And so we talk about that within the document as well. And I think that would be the buffer.
Okay, so we're gonna move on to the little bit into the remaining, or the 11 subsection topics. These include two additional topics that weren't identified in statute, two topics that were added to the nine that listed in statute, and this finishes up the rest of the section. The 11 subsection topics are included in the slide that you see here: residential land uses, streets, roads, highways, ordinary high waters, of public water, or ordinary high water levels, public waters and shorelands, flood protection, wellhead protection areas, critical natural habitat acquisitions, natural resource easements, and then the two that were added during the production of this document was a section on floodplains and a section to discuss cultural resources. These subsections vary in treatment regarding setbacks and buffers, and as with the draft document, and as Bob mentioned earlier, the document doesn't provide specific recommended setbacks, dimensions, or specific buffer designs because of this reason. This is also because planning and official controls, such as zoning and subdivision ordinances, are almost entirely under local jurisdiction. Individual communities may assess and value local resources differently, which does not often go well with a one-size-fits-all federal approach. Also, as you see very shortly in this presentation, we discussed briefly, but some of these subsection topics also fall under existing regulations. And I just want to point out that because of the variety of and differences between these sections, we're not going to go into specific detail on each section, but we're going to provide the broad overview of the section as well. Now, those subsection topics with which the local government has the primary authority over the implementation or the establishment or requirements of setbacks and buffers includes these subsection topics that we see above: residential
resource easements, floodplains, and cultural resources. Some of the sections, subsection topics in this section of the document have existing state regulations or standards and criteria that already provide some level of regulation oversight. These topics generally focus on existing regulations, or the subsection topics and discussion in the document generally focus on existing regulations or processes and how local government units can work with agencies in applying them to their local ordinances or in their local permitting process, such as the example that was brought up earlier in Teresa's discussion on commenting during permitting processes. Those subsection topics in which the agencies have responsibility include the ones that you're looking at here on the slide in front of you, ordinary high water levels of public waters and shorelands, designated trout streams and class 2A waters, calcareous fens, and wellhead protection areas. I do want to point out that a quick comment regarding section 3, which is on the ordinary high water level of public waters and shorelands, and I kind of abbreviated it on the slide, I apologize for that. Specific to the discussion of shorelands and shoreline management programs, the document does provide a discussion on what a shoreline management program is, how it was established and how it pertains can be served by local government units. The DNR has established minimum shoreline standards for land development that counties have adopted in their local land use controls. Some municipalities may not have adopted shoreline ordinances. In these situations, the establishment of setbacks and or buffers to facilitate land operation would fall to the local government unit. Or local governments can choose to work with the DNR to establish shoreline ordinances as well in this process. So I just wanted to point that out, that was kind of local and state authorities associated with it. So just to touch on how local government units can participate in the processes in which state governments or state agencies have more of the lead regulatory authority as local governments can provide input to state agency permitting processes, such as the water appropriation permit process, public waters permit application. They're usually notified at the time that an application is available for review, and they get the 30-day or so review period to do that. Local government units can also adopt ordinances, just as mentioned on the previous slide, the shoreline ordinances, or they can add additional protection to, or for additional protection to these resources if they wanted to require a proposer to have a setback in a buffer. They can also have other ordinances in place that provide added protection. And when developing or mending ordinances, just to point out, local government units do have the ability to apply more restrictive conditions than the federal or state minimums. So in the instance of shoreline ordinances or floodplain management, local governments do have the ability to strengthen those as needed or as necessary for their reasons. So for the section, for section E on considerations for setbacks and buffers, this section received about 35 individual, had 35 individual commenters about. And these were commenters that were specific to the December and January public comment period. Several or most of these comments really were in regards to subsection topics that needed clarification through either reorganization of details, adding definitions, and or providing additional information on certain topics. As appropriate and in line with the intent of the tools document, these items have been addressed in the final document. Several comments were also received regarding mining density and overlay districts, which are also options for local government units to consider when in their local planning. The section does not, the information in the section does not offer specific recommendations of what an appropriate density may be or where it may be appropriate to place an overlay district. This is because some communities have found that limiting the amount of mines or distributing them throughout their jurisdiction is an approach that works for them. Other communities have found that focusing mining to mining districts is a better option for them. For example, there are infrastructure considerations
community resources, whether or not there's a lot of recreational resources, density of other developments in the area that need to be in consideration when adopting or deciding where to place these projects. And as a result, there's no one-size-fits-all answer that we felt was appropriate to provide in this document, as it really comes down to a community-based decision. We also want to point out that local government units, readers will note that several changes have also been made to the subsection E1, which is residential land uses. This was done as several comments were received during the comment period regarding clarity, questions on clarity, and how the information was presented in the draft, similar to kind of the rewrite of the introduction piece. As with the background and introduction portion of the document, the overall context and information provided in the subsection does go remain the same as how the information was provided in the draft document. Both a comment that we received was in both the subsection E2 streets, roads, and highways, and within the residential land use section, we provided tables that kind of laid out what was found during the local government surveys on existing setbacks that are in place for residential land uses, residential density areas, and streets, roads, and highways. We received several comments that requested additional information as to, when were those setbacks established? If there was a higher number or lower number, were those recent ones, or are those setbacks or ordinances that have been placed for 25 or 40 years? The survey data, unfortunately, the survey data that we collected during the production of this document did not get into the specifics on when those ordinances were established. We were looking more for a range of numbers that were currently being used by local governments, and so we're unable to provide that level of information in this document. One of the resources mentioned earlier, where we have on the EQ website that provides links to existing ordinances, it might be a good resource to find out those specific information or contacting local governments themselves. So we apologize that we can't provide that level of detail, and that item has been clarified in the final document. And I just also want to point out that the survey was taken during the preparation of the draft of this document, so any ordinances or changes to ordinances that have taken place during that time frame aren't reflected in this document as well. I'm going to leave an example of that in this way here, that if some changes are adopted more strictly, and that won't be reflected in the table that you see here. We only represent the ordinances during the time frame. And then we received comments on the subsection of E5, which is on the designated trout streams in Class 2A waters. And I'm going to take a few minutes to talk specifically about this section. Approximately a third of the comments that we received pertaining to this particular section expressed concerns for this specific subsection. Because of this, it appeared to be this was a very sensitive topic for commenters, and so we wanted to take a few minutes to focus specifically on those comments received and how it relates to the final document. So the slide in front of you summarizes the majority of comments really that you received regarding this particular subsection. Overall, there is several comments that just express general concern for these resources or value resources for ecotourism reasons, and a lot of people live in the area for the reason that they enjoy and value these resources in their backyards. There are specific comments, and then there's a handful of very specific comments that included establishing 1 mile or greater setbacks from all trout streams, tributaries, requesting that a standard be established to set a minimum separation between the mining and groundwater levels, limiting groundwater use no more than 1 million gallons per year, which is the trigger for a proposal needing a water appropriation permit with the Department of Natural Resources, and generally just asking for more information on the trout stream designation process. So with regards
to designate trout streams, and this is specific in the statute they the statute that was created for from legislation was specific to the Paleozoic Plateau. The 2013 legislation prohibited the excavation or mining of silica sands in this region that for areas that are in 1 mile of any designated trout stream, unless a silica sand mining trout stream setback permit is issued by the DNR. So following this legislation, the DNR has developed a process to administer the silica sand mining trout stream setback permit. The process includes an extensive hydrogeologic evaluation and any other information necessary to assess potential impacts to trout streams, springs, seeps, calcareous fens, domestic wells, and other hydrogeologic features. The document does provide more detail on what this looks like and the discussion of the permit application submittal requirements and any necessary coordination that's required for the proposal to within the Department of Natural Resources and local government units. Based on the results of these studies, and now I'm referring to the hydrogeologic evaluation that's required for the permitting process, and any other application information or data received, the results may identify the need for setbacks or any other restrictions necessary to protect these resources. And this information will be based on site-specific and scientifically found technical information. Completion of these studies in the application does not guarantee that a permit will be granted. And if one was approved, the commissioner, the DNR commissioner, has the authority to place any restrictions necessary in that permit application. And those could include some of the ones that were mentioned before. Could be for that particular mine, there might be a limit established on how far a depth could establish additional setbacks to other rare features or sensitive features in the area. And as we mentioned, you know, one of the subsection categories in this section itself is on calcareous fens, and those have other layers of protection as well. As these resources are not features that occur solely within the Paleozoic Plateau, the information included in the recommendations, standards, criteria, and considerations portion of the document also points out that LGUs in the Minnesota River Valley or any other areas of the state where there's concern for impacts to these resources could adopt a similar process or ask for similar or some of the same level of information that we have established for this trout stream setback permit process. LGUs can ask for an extensive hydrogeologic evaluation, limited applicable more. Those are freedoms that local governments have. And like I said, it can be similar. It can be the same that the DNR is asking for. They can ask for more information if they feel that there's more. They can, you know, expand that area to what they feel is necessary to provide protection to those resources. And assistance is available to local government units outside the Paleozoic Plateau. Those are areas that would be covered by this silica sand mining trout stream setback permit. They can still get assistance from the Department of Natural Resources. Specific to silica sand, as mentioned previously in the introduction slides of this presentation, there's a technical assistance team that has been created specific to silica sand, and they can be asked for guidance or help into, you know, evaluating studies or determining what studies are needed in their areas. And as tap in on something that Heather mentioned, local government units can also hire consultants. You know, if they're concerned of how they're going to do this, they don't have the level of expertise. They can also hire consultants at the cost of a proposer to do some of these evaluations or work with proposers on the in regards to the trout stream designation process, additional information has been added to the final document that provides a little bit more detail on the rulemaking process that's involved with that and it does lay out an estimated time frame for when we plan to update the designated trout stream list. There's no set time that we do that, but we are working on developing that list and moving forward with any potential designations of it. And like I said, there's a process to do that. On the slide in front of you, I just pointed out some of the topics that I touched on a little bit.
And then I included a list here for some of the criteria that was used to develop the level of detail that the VUNAR has for their hydrogeologic evaluation. And I focused on that, but I want to include, and this is laid out in the document in a lot greater detail. It does require a lot of coordination with the developer. There's discussions on where to establish what level, I think, because I mentioned any, you know, could include other information. And so there's a detailed discussion that occurred between the VUNAR and the proposer and local governments can participate in that process as well to help to identify where those features are, where those potential concerns are, when that 1 mile trigger is reached. So like I said, I wanted to just take a moment to kind of point out directly the trust required because within this section that was the topic that can be an area of concern for a lot of local governments and other commenters for this document. And with that, I just want to copy what Will said earlier on behalf of the staff, on behalf of the staff who work on this document. We want to thank you for public comment participation. It helps us know what you guys are thinking, what's important to you, and helps us hopefully make this a better and more usable document for local governments and review.
Thank you, Melissa. Questions for Melissa or Bob from members of the board? Seeing none, again, thanks to all of you. This is a team effort. It's a 191 or two or three page document. And good work on all of your parts. So thanks again. At this point in time, we'll move into the testimony portion. I would ask if there are other purple sheets out there, please bring them forward and we can consider those. We have Ken at this point in time, and I'd like to start with Ken Schomper. Great to see you, Ken.
Good to see you, Commissioner.
Former state representative. And Ken also lives on Chomper Road, and I'm wondering, you know, how you go about getting, did you like move there because it was named Chomper Road, or did they name it after you?
You have hearty great
grandparents. Yeah, I suspect that's it.
They came from Switzerland and Homestead.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Commissioner, and all of you commissioners and citizens members. I'm Ken Jumper. I live in Rural and Crescent. I've lived in Rural and Crescent all my life. I have the following comments in regards to your consideration of the findings before you, which I read through last night and have been following. After reading through the proposed findings of facts for tools to assist local government in regulating SOCA sand mining, I would argue very strongly that number 11 is severely deficient, and that nowhere are there any tools for local governments to use in developing local ordinances, if they wanted, to prohibit silica sand mining. I would argue that there could have been. For example, it seems to me that each of the areas where standards and criteria were discussed could have included references to various parameters that lacked a high level of certainty in regards to how they would impact human activity, air and water pollution, for instance. And that this lack of certainty could be used by a local government unit to decide to regulate silica sand mining by prohibiting it. By failing to point out that there is much in regards to silica sand mining's impact that we lack knowledge of and conclusions about, the findings in a very slanted and biased way convey the typical regulation, that is, allowing silica sand mining under certain criteria is a sufficient outcome. The message is clear that these tools totally comprise the only necessary approach for local government officials to consider. Only one approach to deal with the threat of silica sand mining is given validity. To regulate silica sand mining is to allow it. On the other hand, no reasonable person can deny that prohibiting silica sand mining is a valid approach to regulating it, if the term is used in its broadest sense. I am aware that the model ordinances from the two townships that have acted to prohibit silica sand mining are included in the model ordinances. That, however, is not sufficient or balanced given the amount of the report dedicated to promoting a typical regulatory approach. I think that most of us would acknowledge that the technical and scientific expertise to deal with silica sand mining, and we certainly got a glimpse of that in the presentations today, exceeds the capabilities and budgets of many local government units. So local government officials will quite understandably be inclined to follow and give high credence to these tools. The problem, of course, in doing so, they are only getting half of the real picture. The truth is that this is just as valid and reasonable, to prohibit silica sand mining as it is to allow it under some regulatory scheme. I would argue it is reasonable and it is intelligent and it is responsible to conclude that the sum total of all of the silica sand mining activities are so severe, so detrimental, so damaging, and so long-term that prudent and rational local officials would not allow this type of activity. But for our local government leaders to come to this conclusion and decision in the face of these overwhelmingly biased and slanted tools is unrealistic and disingenuous, in my opinion. This is a set of proposals that unmistakably recommends and promotes allowing silica sand mining. A document like this, just by virtue of its existence, creates and ingrains expectations, conclusions, and endpoints. If this document does not include even a rudimentary discussion of prohibiting silica sand mining, that option is permanently marginalized and dismissed. So I'm not modest, commissioners. I learned that in the legislature.
Other than that, how do you do?
So I really would like to urge you to send it back to the staff. I think it could be crafted better to give some validity to this idea that you really could prohibit frac sand mining in southern Minnesota and do it for very good reasons. So thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Good seeing you. Good to see you as well.
Brett Corrigan, Mr. Corrigan. I know I saw you walk in, Fred. From Corrigan Road, right? Welcome, Fred.
Thank you. Still recovering.
Are you really?
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to keep it brief. I know there are other speakers that are going to speak to some of these topics as well. So I did want to comment, though, in a paragraph in the document, and I was just looking to see if I had the right page number, so I won't refer to the page number, but it refers to, and I quote, "While the Seward County regulates one of the largest producing silica sand mines in the country, other communities have little or no experience regulating large-scale mining operations. With that said, much of the regulatory framework that is applied to other metallic mining, like crushed stone and sand and gravel, is applicable to regulating the operations of silica sand projects. Notable differences generally considered unique to silica sand mining include multiple modes, overall length of transportation, and the more common use of flocculants for the processing of silica sand into frac sand." 200 pages later, we've addressed what appears to be not a great deal of difference between our traditional aggregate and non-metallic mining and silica sand mining. I'm speaking today on behalf of the aggregate miners, many of whom commented on this document, and are very concerned that there's no language, while this document refers to silica sand mining and repeatedly, there's really no language in this document to reflect that these provisions should not apply to aggregate and ready mix or aggregate operations throughout the state. We think it's unreasonable or unrealistic to expect a local official to be able to talk about these conditions with a neighbor to a miner or to an existing mine without having these conditions brought up as part of that discussion. Our aggregate miners produced many comments to this draft, and we were discouraged that many of them appear not to have been reflected in this document, and hope that the EQB will table this document so that these comments can be better dealt with. I will discuss just three of these comments that were brought up by traditional aggregate
operations, lighting, for instance. They're confused about the conditions that are mentioned here. Many of them work on road projects, MnDOT, and other projects that require them to be open 24 hours a day. And as was mentioned earlier, there are safety requirements that come from MSHA and OSHA for mine workers working on these sites and on these projects, delivering product to state projects and private sector projects. Diesel engines. Almost all of the fleets that haul aggregates in the state work with IPOs, independent truckers. We have no idea how we would enforce the conditions if they were applied to an aggregate operation, because this is not our equipment. It's not the equipment of the mine. It may not even be the equipment of the project that it's going to. The difference between road and off-road diesel engines is also curious to us. We're not sure why there should be a difference between equipment that's coming in to pick up this product and equipment that's moving product on the site itself. And lastly, just to emphasize, I think, the connection that our members worry about, that this document will roll over into traditional aggregate operations, is the issue of setbacks, which was just discussed. It's our understanding in Goodhue County that some of these proposed setbacks have been included in a new ordinance in Goodhue County, and that one of the operations of Goodhue County will not be able to renew its IUP because of those setbacks. That results in the loss of a resource to the community and coincidentally adds many new trucks to the roads because of the distances that will need to be hauled to serve that community. Again, we appreciate all the hard work that has been put into this document, especially and compliment the DNR for its changes that were incorporated after the comments were made. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Fred. Questions for Fred? If not, thank you very much. Ms. Amy Nelson. Welcome, Amy. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Nice to see you, too. For those of you who don't know, I'm Amy Nelson. I live in Goodhue County. I'm one of the founders of Save the Bluffs, and I'm also the chair of the Planning Commission for Hay Creek Township. I'd really like to thank you. I really do like this document a lot better. It's a lot more detailed. It has a lot more breadth, a lot more depth. I do want to say it is not aggregate, and I think those definitions, those clear definitions from federal and state should be up front saying this is silica, not aggregate. I do have to say, after about halfway through the presentation today, however, it seemed like it was assuming that every community wants silica and wants mining in their area. And it felt to me as though I was watching a drug commercial. You know the ones where you're looking at it and one-third of the commercial is telling you how wonderful this pill is and how it'll cure you, and the other two-thirds are telling you all of the side effects, those things that could kill you someday? I felt that's like what I was watching. So I think you have to, the toolkit, because of just its name, ends up assuming acceptance. So I think, as was discussed earlier, there has to be some way of saying, hey, you may not want this community, and here are some ways that you can, or here are some communities that have done it yourself. I can understand why you wouldn't want that in the toolkit, because that is the nature of the toolkit. But one of the things that you really could do is specify that in the library. When you specify the library on page 4 and discuss it, and when you go out to the library, you have lots of great links, but you honestly have no idea what those links are, and they aren't even current, and there's no way to even update them yourself as a local government unit to make them so they're accurate. So I think looking at those ordinances, I would look to those to say, what do they say, and what do these mean, and how are these different? I'll give you an example. Hay Creek Township, for example, we ban large commercial mining. We also ban flocculants. Florence ends up banning industrial sand mining, period. Fillmore County ends up banning processing and limits the number of mines. So we all do something differently. I think you could really help LGUs who want to ban by guiding them to resources that would show them how. You can ask LGUs to summarize key aspects of their plans for a site. And if they, if LGUs are willing to actually put that contact information in there, so they can actually contact those and say, how do you do this? In our area, we do this right now with townships who contact us and say, well, what did you do? Why did you do that? What do you have out there? Who did you contact? But they know us. So I think if you did that on the website, I think that would be a way of creating that and seeing that front and center for those local units of government who are trying to do something different other than regulate it to say, no, I don't want it. So just in closing, I'd say don't push the mining and processing on a community that's not really interested in it. Don't make us accept the side effects of it if we don't want it. And I'd say just put options out there for those of us who want to say no. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter Larson. Peter's here on behalf of the Silica Sand Council. He is loaded with documents. Welcome here.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'm Peter Larson. I'm from the law firm of Larson Hoffman, and I'm representing the Minnesota Silica Sand Council. While this is being handed out, I would have to mention, Mr. Chair, that you hardly ever miss a trick, but with the parking issue that you're dealing with, I have to give you a tip that I got from a guy who practiced law in northern Minnesota, who said his partner would say to someone, if they got a parking ticket, give me that, I'll take care of it. And got a great reputation for being well-connected. A parking ticket in that town cost about $2. He would go down and pay them. But he got this great reputation for being so well-connected.
So your
you
point.
Might take that home.
So your point.
You may take that home to Murdoch.
All right.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. We appreciate all the work the staff has done. I don't know if you got something like this, but we were able to prepare a redline version of the previous document and the document that you have now. So we were able to go through and look at the comments that we submitted and how they were addressed. And I've just got a few comments to make, and then we've got a couple other people. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, could we have our folks come back to back just because it's...
If they would be so kind as to fill out a...
They've already filled it.
Oh, it's, all right, okay, yeah. All right. And you've got, is it Brett?
Yep, Chris and Polly, and then a couple of folks from the facility. We thought you might like to hear from me.
And they're okay, well, you bet. Yeah.
So a few comments from me. One, I'm here to kind of set the table and talk about why this is important. And I feel like I'm playing the old game of pong with some of the staff here, but I just want to say it to the front. We know you're not doing rulemaking. We've said that in writing, we've said that every time we've been before you. We know you're not doing rulemaking. And we know you're not putting together a document that's required to be adopted by local governments. So we know both of those, it's very clear. So why do we care so much about this document? Because it's being created by you, and it's going to have an EQB stamp on it, and your state agency members and important citizens. So we care a lot. Now what? Another reason we care is this is going to go to local governments, and a lot of what we do is we have to get conditional use permits. Now, under Minnesota law, local government can only deny a conditional use permit for a couple reasons. One, they have to have a reason related to public health, safety, and general welfare. Or because the proposal is incompatible with the city's comprehensive plan and the uses zone for that property. So to address the issue that people have been bringing up here and your need to tell local governments how to prohibit mining, what I just said is true. Local governments can designate places in their jurisdictions where this is prohibited. And you can't apply for a conditional use permit. So that, just know that's in there. But why is this important to us? So here's how you can deny a conditional use permit, which is what we normally need if you're a local government. There has to be a factually sound basis. Yeah, that's the key. There has to be a factually sound basis, and I already said the reasons have to be related to public health, safety, and general welfare. So our concern is, and we're going to point some things out to you about this, is that your document is going to be brought to local governments. It's going to be a state agency document. It's going to have an EQB label on it, and someone's going to come in and say, you have to do this. Even though the standard for them is they can only deny a CUP if they're protecting public health, it's related to safety or general welfare. So we're going to point out some things here that we think are technically incorrect and require you to take this document back. I'll just say there are just some things in here that are incorrect. And nobody's purposes are served well by that. So just to set the table, there's four things that you're going to hear from us particularly, although we've got several other comments that weren't addressed in here. For example, I'll just throw you out my favorite. There's no description in here of what the legislature did on environmental review this year. There's a list. It lists the new law. But nowhere in here does it say to a local government, the legislature gave you a tool, and here's what's required. And for our purposes, that's the best tool, because you've heard from a lot of your staff that none of this is really one size fits all. And so the legislature gave a tool, and nowhere in this document does it really describe the local governments how they should use that. But that's not the main topic, and that's not something that should make you pull this document back, although if you do, you might want to add that. So several things. One, we think a document has to remove all statements suggesting that operations must be enclosed. And page 35, I don't know if you guys have this document, but page 35, there's a sentence at the bottom. Right into processing. And the statement is, after the sandstone has been mined, all subsequent processing steps should be enclosed. Okay, that's a topic sentence. It's in an important place, and it says something that's wrong. That is factually and technically incorrect. And we're going to talk to you a little bit about that. But that is factually incorrect. But that's a requirement the local government should enclose facilities. So we're going to talk to you a little bit about that. There's language in here about off-road diesel engines that have nothing to do with protecting health or safety. There's a place for those engines, but not here. We're going to talk to you a little bit about that. There's a statement in here about how old the fleet should be of a silicon sand process facility. There's no factual basis for doing that. We've got some suggestions, but that should just be removed. We're no silica sand, the truck doesn't know what it's carrying. And this would apply a restriction to an operation for silica sand that doesn't apply to any other facility in the state of Minnesota. There's a requirement of 1 year pre-construction air quality monitoring. I'm gonna leave that to Kirsten Pauly. She'll talk about that. And also about noise. So the other thing I wanted to do before Kirsten Pauly and Brett, the folks from both Brian Rock Products and Jordan Sands are going to get up here, is what I handed out is this. And this is a very recent air quality permit that the Pollution Control Agency issued for a silica sand mining project in Mankato. And you'll see it's dated October 4th, 2013, so it's less than 6 months old. It was adopted post-legislature. All the discussion that took place last legislative session, all the public attention, the PCA actually took the position that the local government that did the EAW on this, because it was issued after the legislature passed the law with the new EAW requirements, had to make sure that the EAW for this project complied with the new state requirements. So this is brand new. This is state of the art. This is what the agency requires to protect human health and the environment in Minnesota. And it was just issued last October. And I'm going to give you some details, but the summary of what I'm going to show you is that this does not require enclosure. Okay. This had an EAW. Lyon Township, north of Mankato, did it. The proposer hired consultants and a lawyer from the township. The PCA commented on the EAW. The PCA issued the air permit, which is this. It doesn't require enclosure. But you have a statement in your document that says all facilities, all these operations should be enclosed. This document has to be taken back to delete any sort of reference like that, because that's a technically incorrect statement to protect human health and the environment. We have a written statement as well. I know you didn't want to sit here and read our written statement. We'll send it to you. But I just wanted to point out to you a couple things in here. And most importantly, I have some highlighted things in here, but I just want to take you to something called, it's a fugitive dust plan. The agency requires these to be prepared. It doesn't matter. Permit be issued until it's done correctly. And this is an enforceable document. And it has to do with the same thing that you achieve by enclosing operations. But this doesn't require enclosure because it has a fugitive dust plan. And if you want to go through it, you can. I highlighted some things in here. But these are all the requirements that facility has to do because it's not enclosed. And there's also a technical support document here towards the back, and if you want to look at some of the highlighted language, it talks about how the fugitive dust plan is an enforceable part of the document. There's all sorts of provision. Again, the technical support document is what the PCA attaches to the permit, and it's their basis for issuing the permit. What it means is it complies with every single law that's required, and actually probably goes beyond, because some of these laws are more health-based, concentration-based, and specific. So I'll let some other folks come up, but that's why I brought this. We appreciate what the staff did. You heard a lot of comments today about what we're giving people as tools, because it's not a one-size-fits-all regulatory scheme out there. And I want to make sure, too, to the extent this is reported or anybody believes the industry is somehow fighting this, we are not. The comments you're going to hear are about how to achieve goals. They're not about the goals you're pursuing here. All the comments you're going to hear are about methods to achieve goals, not the goals themselves. So I just want to make that note. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if anybody has any questions for you.
I will go directly to Kristen Polly, if that's all right.
Sure.
Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, members of the Environmental Quality Board. My name is Kirsten Pauley. I am a registered professional civil engineer and a registered professional geologist with Sunday Engineering. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Industrial Sand Council. I have been working with the Sand Council, and the Sand Council has been very active in preparing comments and following the drafting of this document. And I would like to say that it's very obvious when we compare the different drafts that many of the comments that were submitted were definitely reviewed. They were obviously considered. There were many changes made. And really, that process is resulting in a much better document, and we really appreciate that effort. The one section that we really have some major issues with is the air quality section. It really does appear that there was not much credence given to the comments that were submitted. And there are some very specific guidelines and recommendations that are really, really troubling to the members of the Sand Council. And so I'd like to talk about some of those very specific recommendations. And Peter did mention that the big one is enclosure. According to the document, enclosing all processes after the sandstone is removed from the mine face includes enclosing crushing, screening, wet processing, and stockpiling operations. And there is no justification provided in this document that would require this to be enclosed in order to protect human health and the environment, or to meet the ambient air standards that are imposed on a federal and state level. So I think that the recommendation really ignores, for months we've been talking about the fact that environmental review is one of the best tools that's available to look at these sites on a site-specific basis. And in that way, you can develop, based on what's being proposed, the appropriate measures to control potential issues. There are many differences among the facilities that are proposed and have been permitted. For example, along the Minnesota River Valley, the majority of the resource is located either partially below the water table or completely below the water table. There's two methods to mine that resource. One is to fully dewater the resource and mine it under dry conditions. If you fully dewater the resource, you are required, depending upon the actual geologic setting, to dewater between 50 and 100 feet in order to dry mine that facility. Dry mining has the advantage that you can mine all year long. The other option is to wet mine. And if you wet mine, you essentially leave the water table at its natural level, and you use a drag line or a dredge to remove the sandstone under wet conditions. And so many of the operations along the Minnesota River Valley are proposing or have been approved to dredge or to drag line in a wet mining condition. What's important to understand about that is in Minnesota, you cannot wet mine year round. There are 4 to 5 months out of the year where frozen conditions make it impossible to conduct the mining year-round. And if you have a wet processing plant outside, that too is impossible to do year-round. And so for these operations, that enclosure becomes very problematic, which I'll get to in a minute. But what's more important is to understand why the enclosure doesn't provide any added benefit in many instances. If you are removing sand from a wet mine, it is saturated. It is completely saturated, and the potential for fugitive dust emissions is essentially zero. That material can be crushed and screened in that saturated condition. It's brought to a wet processing plant. Again, the wet processing plant infers moisture saturation, and what happens in that wet processing plant is the very fine materials that are on the sand, the silts and the very fine sands, are separated out. So what comes out of that wet processing plant is the coarser grain materials. The things that are subject to wind erosion, the silts and the very fine sands, they aren't in that stockpile. That stockpile is coming out at an 8 to 12% moisture content, and there is no way that that represents a significant potential for fugitive dust emissions. Now, for these operations that are wet mining operations and can only mine for a portion of the year, the operations need to mine more material during the spring, summer, and fall, and wet process that material, and build up a stockpile over those three seasons so that they have what's called a winter feed pile. That winter feed pile then is taken, that material is taken during the frozen months and fed into the dry plant year-round. So there's year-round production at these facilities, but they need a large winter stockpile. To give you an example of the sizes of the stockpiles, they vary depending upon how much a plant produces. But for the operations that have recently been approved, those stockpile areas vary from 7 to 12. There's a project that's being proposed where it would require up to a 15-acre stockpile area. To enclose that stockpile area with a building is just infeasible, and there really is no justification for it. I think when when Jeff gave the presentation on the air quality, he said the idea was that you need to control fugitive dust by a number of different measures, and we agree with that. The air quality permits are a great tool to do that. And in the last 2 years, the Pollution Control Agency has issued 3 separate air quality permits. The first one that was issued for a silica sand facility was issued to Shakopee Sands. It was about an 8 to 9 month process, and it was a public process, public participation process. It required the agency to look in great detail about all aspects of the operation, and it included a couple things that are very important to note. One, it allows the outdoor processing screening of sandstone. It does not have to be enclosed. It allows wet processing outside in an unenclosed environment. It also allows stockpiling of a variety of stockpiles, including this larger winter stockpile. But it also includes a fugitive dust control plan, where the operator has control to review their proposed facility and determine what makes the most sense for them, what the most effective best management practices are to control fugitive dust, and to implement the most efficient control technologies for that particular site. So that fugitive dust control plan becomes part of the air permit. And the other unique thing about these facilities is the ambient air monitoring plans. Most industries, when they get an air quality permit, do not have ambient air monitoring component. The industry recognized early on that because there was some data gaps, because there were concerns and questions, that they actually were the first ones to say to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, we're proposing an ambient air monitoring plan. And so I think it's important to recognize that this is a real unique aspect of an air quality permit, and it serves a great purpose. It's also interesting to note that the ambient air monitoring plan, there's one provision in this guideline that says there should be a 1-year pre-construction air monitoring period. The Great Plains, or the Shakopee Sands permit does not require any 1 year pre-construction, any 1 month pre-construction period. And the reason is, inherent in these plans, there are in all instances an upwind and a downwind monitor and a meteorological station, so that you're always measuring, when you're taking your readings, you're measuring conditions that are reflective of what's coming into the facility, what's leaving the facility, so you can actually analyze what effect that facility is having on ambient air quality. The other permit that has been recently issued is Tiller Corporation up in North Branch. Again, this is about a 9 or 10 month process, public process that the public was involved in. The agency went through with tremendous detail. And again, interesting to note that outdoor storage of stockpiles is allowed under that permit. It also has an ambient air monitoring plan and a fugitive dust control plan that is specific to what processes are occurring at that facility. And again, the air monitoring does not require any kind of pre-construction period. The other thing to note is both the Shakopee Sands and the Tiller Corporation sites have been collecting data now for over 1 year, and there's no indication that these sites are exceeding any state or federal ambient air quality standards. And I think it's important to recognize that this ambient air monitoring plan is there to show, to prove to agencies, to the communities, to the public, that the best management practices that are adopted at these sites are effective. And if there are air monitoring levels that are approaching standards, operations can be adjusted, but you don't start out by enclosing a 10-acre stockpile. The very last permit that was recently issued is what Peter Larson was talking about, the Jordan Sands facility. And again, the very important things to note on that, it again was a 9 or 10 month process, and it resulted in a permit that allows outdoor storage of stockpiles. It allows outdoor crushing and screening. It also requires a fugitive dust control plan, again, prepared by the operator, utilizing what they believe the most effective and efficient best management practices will be.
Kristen, could I be so rude as to say, could you work toward wrapping up? I've got 7 more folks here, and we're on the clock for 4 o'clock.
So I'm almost done.
Good, thank you.
Okay.
My humble apologies.
So that permit also recently issued allows for these things that this guide, this toolbox is saying is no longer valid. And in my opinion, I will wrap it up right now, that we request that some of these overreaching recommendations, such as the enclosure of the materials and processes, the 1 year pre-construction monitoring, be removed from the document. They have no scientific basis. They have no justification. They're not part of any recent permit. They show an industry bias, and they're simply not feasible. Consideration of these kinds of prescriptive type recommendations can certainly be evaluated during the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's rulemaking process that's currently underway. They just simply do not belong in this document. So thank you very much for
Thank
your
you. Time. Thank you very much. Brett Skilbreth? Brett's here representing Jordan Sand, and welcome.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner.
And keep in mind, Brett was the one that informed me that you could go to the Peter, go to the desk up here.
And, so I have a connection.
Yeah, so he's in. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, commissioners, members of the board,
good
thank
to
you
see.
For hearing our public comments here today. And I appreciate all the work that's been done on this document. I'm here representing Jordan Sands as the Director of Project Development, and over the past 2 years have been working very closely with our local government unit as well as with the state agencies to work through the environmental review process as well as the permitting process, ultimately resulting in a conditional use permit that I think our local government unit is very proud of and very confident in its ability to regulate our operation, as well as Peter mentioned, an air emissions permit that has been deemed adequate to protect public health and safety. Also, I have been participating in the state rulemaking, on the state rulemaking committee for silica sand. And we've had two meetings to date, and so I'd just like to provide a little bit of commentary on the discussions that have ensued during those meetings and how this group really sees its role on this committee and what the rulemaking process, what the goals of the rulemaking process really are. The first meeting was really about purpose, setting some ground rules. The second meeting was all about air quality standards. So Jeff gave us a very nice overview of the current air quality standards, how permits are written, how they're regulated, and how they're enforced. And then a discussion ensued that included conversation about this very permit in and of itself and whether or not it was adequate to protect human health and safety. And from our perspective, the conversation resulted in a resounding yes, that it does. The only caveat to that was that Jeff stated that there are certain gaps in the rules that would not have allowed him to include things in this permit if we wouldn't have agreed as an operator. And those two things are the Fugitive Dust Control Plan and the Air Monitoring Plan. So as we started to talk further about why are we here, what rules are we making, and what is the goal, the result of that conversation is the goal is to plug those gaps to make sure that rules exist to write an air emissions permit with the authority of rule to include fugitive dust and air monitoring. But nowhere in that conversation did we ever talk about enclosures. So what we're here asking today is that we really find it hard to prove that there's a need for certain standards in this document that don't exist in current permits that are deemed to adequately provide for public health and safety. We also want to agree with Commissioner Landwehr in that these standards should support current and future rules. Thus, until the document better reflects the current regulatory environment, the future rules, and the current process that's being undertaken to plug those gaps, and then also eliminates control mechanisms with no proof of need, we ask that it's tabled. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Brett. I'd like to ask Matt Bryan to come forward.
Chairman, good to see you. Chairman, members of the board, thank you for having me. My name is Matt Bryan. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Bryan Rock Products. I'm also a part of Greater Junction Sand. A lot of you know the story, but I'll just tell it again anyways. Bryan Rock's been around since 1941. We're approaching 75 years, and I'm the fourth generation to be involved in the operations of the company. We have operations in Shakopee, Hastings, Bayport. We drill and blast and crush rock in all those locations. Merriam Junction Sands was formed several years ago as a partnership between us and another property owner adjacent to the railroad tracks from us to permit and begin mining silica sand. We are 1 mile north of the Shakopee Sands project, which you've heard a lot about, and just appreciate you letting me comment on some of the sections of this. We've heard a lot about the enclosure thing, so I'll try to be as brief as possible on it. But it's one of the biggest concerns we had when reading the document was that because we are looking at three projects that have been permitted in 3 years, and part of our due diligence project, which has been 3 years of dedicating ourselves and doing the EIS, was looking at those permits and seeing how those permits went. None of those permits required indoor storage and all indoor processes. So this was very problematic for us. But you've heard a lot of the justification for it. But I think one of the big things was Mr. Schneiser said at the beginning was this was meant to be a toolbox. Local town, LGUs could take stuff from and help permit. It seems that is less of a tool and more of the building set for you, and those are the things that we're concerned about, is when you have those recommendations in here and very little justification for them, that it'll make it difficult for us down the road with these local governments. And the other one is, that I'll just mention today, is the section on tiered engines. We're in a unique position in our quarry, and Shakopee, where we will have limestone mining along with silica sand mining contiguously during our process. The recommendation is that certain tier motors wouldn't be allowed for certain types of off-road vehicles and commercial vehicles. That would require us to have someone waiting at the gate, check the motor to make sure they meet the tier requirement, and then they could go for silica sand. Where that would be problematic, not only just having someone have to check motors, would be we could have a city come in for limestone for ball field aggregate one day. In an older vehicle, some cities don't have all the updated equipment, and the next day come in for a load of bunker sand for silica sand, and we wouldn't be allowed to load them because the product would be different in the truck. Same area, different product, different regulations. And that seems a bit onerous and maybe a bit of an overreach as far as how to regulate that type of process. Also, with the off-road vehicles, we all have contiguous operations in sometimes the same area, sometimes not, but I could have a loader that maybe isn't rated as high tier. I can use the limestone operations, but I can't use it 100 feet away just because what's in the bucket is different. And those are just a few of the recommendations that I think maybe go a little further than you can go and what the intent of the document was. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Keith Lawson. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, board members. My name is Keith Lawson. I'm a township supervisor in Hay Creek, Minnesota. And I've had the privilege, because of another effort I've been doing lately, of giving listening sessions and meeting with local government officials over the last 2 to 3 months. Specifically, I'm in Goodhue County, and because of one of the things I'm working on, I'm talking to people in the 4th District. So that goes from Lake City up through Lawrence, Frontenac, down through Hay Creek, great trout fishing stream there in Hay Creek. Actually, some of the board members have seen a lot of trout in Hay Creek. They haven't caught many, but they've seen quite a few. And then it goes down through Goodhue and into Zumbrota. Our biggest concern is economic development. And through these listening sessions, I've talked to dozens of local government officials, many, many citizens. They don't believe, you know, and actually, to start with, the first lobbyist for Sam I spoke said local units of government or government units already can prohibit permits for sand mining, and he's right. They don't believe it, though. They're scared that either through lobbyists and lawyers, they're going to get rolled over. I mean, some of these local government officials come in bib overalls after they get done milking the cows. That's our local government here in Minnesota. So they're not sophisticated on the rules and laws. What I want to see and hear added, and by the way, I've had a chance on the rulemaking committee to work with some of your staff, smart, respectful people. They really are. They're a good bunch. This is some good work. But I think the comment has to be in here, you do have the right, as a local government unit, not to issue a permit within this statute in this way. Because they don't believe me. I've talked to hundreds of them, and they said, oh, no, those lawyers are going to come in and they're going to crush us. I said, no, you can do it. Stand up for yourselves. If you don't want this activity in your local government unit, say so. You don't have to have it. But that's what I think needs to be added to this, so that they can stand up, come in from milking the cows, get together and say, you know what, we don't want that here. So we're not going to issue a permit, and we have the right not to because of this. Maybe a different way of looking at that. They already have the right to say, I don't want it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Keith, and I'm going to get rid of my overalls right now, I'll tell you. Are they back again?
For women.
Thank you. Let's go then to Joanna. Joanna Rupert, representing Land Stewardship Project. Welcome, Joanna. Good to see you again.
Good afternoon. My name is Johanna Ruprecht. I live in Winona, and I work for the Land Stewardship Project in our Southeast Minnesota office in Lewiston, and I'd like to make a few comments on behalf of LSP today on the document before you. So over the last few months, LSP, many citizens, and even the Board of Commissioners of Houston County have all asked for the EQB to give guidance to local communities on how they can ban frac sand mining. We know that many communities are going to and already have looked at this industry and determined that it's incompatible with what they want for their community, with what they've identified in their comprehensive plans and so on. And what they're going to want to do is prohibit it. And that guidance is still lacking in this document. So I want to echo what Keith and others have said already, that that is a problem, because this document is being presented in the media as an authoritative guide for local governments. Even really the title itself is problematic in that it says, tools to assist local governments in planning for and regulating silica sand projects. So implying that the only option a local government has is to accept the presence of this industry and figure out how to regulate it. And that's just not the case. So I do appreciate the mention in the introduction on what Will mentioned earlier, that acknowledging that there are other tools available, but I think that's something that really needs to be highlighted more clearly, is that other options are available that are not contained in this document. That includes other options that some communities are already currently using. So, for instance, in the ordinance library, you do include Florence Township's ordinance, which bans crack sand mining. And I would suggest, echoing what Amy Nelson mentioned earlier, that in the ordinance library, if you were to add a description next to each ordinance to explain what it says and what it does, that would help make that tool more helpful for citizens and local governments. So, for instance, by Florence Township's ordinance, you could say, this is the township that chose to prohibit frack sand mining, and here is what their ordinance doing that looks like. That additional information in the ordinance library would be very helpful. I also wanted to speak briefly on the issue of trout streams. So, last legislative session, the DNR and Commissioner Landwehr testified several times on what would be the minimum requirements needed to protect trout streams from this industry. The first of those points was a ban on mining within 1 mile of all designated trout streams, Class 2A waters, perennial tributaries of designated trout streams, and Class 2A waters and springs, especially those feeding designated trout streams and tributaries. So it's a problem, and it's disappointing that this document does not really strongly and clearly reaffirm those recommendations as requirements that local governments ought to put in place. And also on the trout stream issue, I have a question and a concern about the accuracy of one of the statements here on page 157 of the document regarding the current DNR trout stream permit requirements. So on the bottom of page 157 reads, in essence, State Statute 103G.217, Driftless Area Water Resources, provides a 1 mile setback from designated trout streams, tributaries to designated trout streams, streams that potentially could be designated trout streams, Class 2A streams, and the springs and seeps that discharge groundwater to trout streams, unless and until the DNR commissioner is satisfied that the proposed silica sand mining activity will not have a detrimental impact. But in the language of the statute itself, so this is Section B of that statute referenced, so within the boundaries of the Department of Natural Resources Paleozoic Plateau Ecological Section, no excavation or mining of silica sand, including but not limited to digging, excavating, mining, drilling, blasting, tunneling, dredging, stripping, or shafting, may occur within 1 mile of a designated trout stream, as listed in Minnesota rules, unless a silica sand mining trout stream setback permit has been issued by the commissioner. And also on the DNR fact sheet from their website about this permit process, that says the permit process is limited to proposals to excavate or mine silica sand within 1 mile of any designated trout stream in the Paleozoic Plateau Ecological Section of Minnesota. So the concern here is that the way this document before you today interprets the statute seems to be different both from the DNR's interpretation and from the language of the statute itself. So your document is implying that the trout stream permit process would also apply to or also protect other waters that are not actually listed in the statute. So those tributaries, other Class 2A waters, things in addition to the designated trout streams themselves. And I remember in one of the slides that Ms. Dobrowski had up there, it seemed to be implying also that that permit process applies to Class 2A waters as well as designated trout streams. So that's an issue that needs to be clarified, I think, today if possible, which interpretation is right. So there's an error in this document about what is actually protected by that permit process, and that's something that would be very important to correct. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Joanne. John Herman. John? Yeah, okay. Welcome, John. John is here on behalf of Unimet. Nice to see you again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, it's always fun to drive to Rochester, though it was a lot more fun when my daughter was down here and had the granddaughter with her, so it's a little bit bittersweet to arrive here.
And see us?
And see all of you.
Oh, yeah. We love you too.
Everybody from the EQB should come to the Minnesota Environmental Law Institute. This year we're going to have a panel discussion about the last 40, 50 years of environmental law with some legislators from the 1970s. Eldon Call, who was the agency's lawyer, the Pollution Control Agency's lawyer for a long time, is going to moderate the panel, and it's going to be quite interesting to talk about the ebb and flow of environmental law. Members of the board, my name is John Herman. I'm a lawyer at Fagree, one of those suits, I guess, that can roll over local government willy-nilly if they want to. I represent Unum Corporation. As I think all of you know, we're the largest frac sand producer in the world, and we have the largest frac sand mine in North America, located here in Minnesota in Le Sueur County. And I think we've been able to show the board and many of the commissioners the kind of practices that we use, which have avoided many problems. And frankly, within our own permitting process in a relatively small county, I would say we've experienced the capability, the robustness of Minnesota's historical environmental laws in their best implementation. The county hired the same engineer who's here for the Industrial Sand Council to work with them as a consultant. They've hired other environmental consulting firms to review complex information, and they have implemented conditional use permits for us on multiple sites with multiple kinds of operations, with literally hundreds of individual performance standards that have allowed the industry there to work with almost no environmental or community opposition and to be viewed as a long-term community benefit. I think the new book or the new model guidance document is a huge improvement over the prior version for many of the reasons that you've already heard, and certainly the reasons your staff has explained, because I think it has taken a good step in the direction of helping local governments understand, number one, how strong their tools are, and number two, what the right role for them is, what kind of local regulatory issues they should be focused on, and how they should work with state agencies in terms of the regulations the state agencies already have, and the more that we're going to have soon in terms of regulating these projects. I would say I still feel that the EIS tool was downplayed in the document as the most fundamental way that local governments, who are the RGUs on most of these projects, how they can use that tool in order to anticipate problems, evaluate the problem, and then develop the specific CUP requirements that they might want to impose on their issues. Uniman has done, I don't know, four or five EAWs and three full EISs on its project. Others of the projects, as you heard from Mr. Larson, have had EAW review, some of them the more robust review under the new statute. And this is the critical tool. This is the tool that, number one, lets you take a reasonable amount of time to figure out the project. You're not bound by the 60-day rule with respect to how quickly you have to turn around the local land use permit. And number two, it's how you get all the information on alternatives and feasible mitigation measures. And I would recommend, I know there are a lot of references here to how you can tie into the system of the EQB and use it better, but I would recommend that you have a section that tells the local governments about how clearly how they can have the proposer pay for all of this, how the system more completely works, so it's all in one place. I think that would be very helpful. A lot of the counties have adopted explicit requirements, not only for EAW, but also for their conditional use permit, that the applicant will pay for all of these costs. And we understand that as a longtime operator in Minnesota, and I think it would allay a huge amount of this hyperbolic concern that the regulatory heft of local government is insufficient to deal with these kind of projects. I also think that although a much better job again with respect to what it means to have zoning powers, I think that there's very little mention of how robust this conditional use permit tool is. All of the projects that have been approved have extraordinary conditional use permits. Permits that have not one or two conditions or a handful of conditions, but often approaching 100 or even more than 100 specific conditions about how you operate and what the rules are with respect to the operation. And what those will allow you to do is tailor the specifics of your controls to the specific place, because every place is different, and I do think the document's good on that. It also doesn't really tell people, I would take the different approach. The concept here isn't to be uniform, let's ban this, it's a terrible thing. The right concept ought to be to utilize your land use planning processes and authority to decide where this is an appropriate use. Anticipate if you've got great resources and a place where it is appropriate, and utilize your zoning districts properly to, number one, protect the resource from incompatible development before it might happen, and number two, tell people in advance where it's appropriate to do it, because it's a designated mining zone or it's an overlay area where mining is permitted. And there is some mention of that, but perhaps not enough to allow people to say, hey, I need to think about, is this an industry we might want to have and where we want to have it. Having said those things, I think the document is a, as I said, a dramatic improvement, much improved in clarifying the regulatory regime of the state as compared to the places where local government should infill and fit into the process. The one thing I would talk about specifically that is, I think, still an area of concern to all of us in the industry, and I don't feel like the document is fairly reflecting the information available, is air quality. There's been a very substantial concern expressed by many citizens about silica dust and silicosis. You heard what Ms. Pauly said about many of these locations where the material is stockpiled already are washed and don't have the fines. We now have a year's worth of monitoring data at several facilities in Minnesota. We have way more than that now being made public in Wisconsin. And what this data is showing, I think without any exception, is that the larger scale facilities with proper dust management plans not only do not have any material emissions at all, but the monitored levels, seemingly regardless of wind direction, are comparable to background levels found for historical periods of decades in the upper Midwest in EPA monitoring. And I just don't think that this is a area where there should be the suggestion that very substantial, very expensive monitoring is appropriate for most of these situations. Now, I'm not speaking specifically to any individual transshipping facility in an immediate downtown, but the larger scale issue of overall silica mining, I really think that air quality, there should be more information about this new data promulgated, because the concerns that have been expressed simply are not factually based in terms of any probability of real world exposure.
John, I'm going to ask you to explain it up.
The other area where I think there's a little concern on our company's part is with the references to flocculants, the suggestion that they're used in these industries and maybe not very commonly throughout many industries, or that they aren't regulated properly. I think if there is a need for any kind of controls there, they ought to be considered in a generic way by the Pollution Control Agency. But flocculants are frequently actually required in the permitting. They also are used in widespread use in water treatment plants and dozens of industries. This is a little like the comment about diesel engines. You know, we probably don't want to have a whole bunch of industry-specific regulation in this area, particularly originated at the local governmental level, which probably is not a good place to do that. If there is a need, it ought to be done at the state agency level, if anywhere at all. So with those comments, I echo what many have said. This is a tribute to the hard work of the staff. I think the EQB and the evolution of this has done a good job of moving it to the direction of being a much more appropriately laid out document, and with a lot of good cross-references to available references that are online or available in the library, and I think it's going to help to alleviate a lot of concerns that people have in southeastern Minnesota about whether or not they have adequate tools to respond as the industry presumably will develop over the years. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
And certainly, as you all know, Uniman is happy to have tours at the plant and show off what the way we do it. We're not saying it's the way everybody should do it, but we're proud of our own operations.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Ellen Mueller. Ellen, welcome. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, Mr. Chairman, board members. Obviously, this is an extremely complex issue, technically, politically, and in any other way that one might want to look at it. And the standards and criteria document itself is not one that I have seen any direct counterpart to anywhere else. It's an interesting mixture of technical and policy. In many ways, it appears to be a de facto rulemaking, although it's not being carried out as such. It seems to me that each iteration of it has been significantly improved, but I don't think that the one that we have now is one that either side would agree we're there yet. And I'll just mention a couple of points. The representatives of the Stamp Council have pointed out that there are recommendations in this document that are not reflected in recently issued air permits for sand mining operations. And I think that's true, but it certainly is not an argument that those recommendations should be taken out of this document. Or rather, it might be taken as a testimony to the weaknesses of the MPCA's air permitting program as it's presently being operated. I think any objective observer of that, whether they agreed with it or not, would note that the focus for the last few years has been on streamlining, quote-unquote, and on accommodating the expectations of applicants, rather than the aggressive, precautionary, forward-looking efforts to protect public health, which of course, I would argue for. So the requirements in the document are certainly not overreaching and unjustified. Just this past week, there's an interesting report has been published in Environmental Health Perspectives, and it's entitled, I won't go on about this at length, but it's about the health effects of coarse particulate matter air pollution from a rural location. The authors are Brooke Bard and some others, and I'll leave you with a copy. But I want to read you a couple of lines from their discussion. Our findings show for the first time that the inhalation of coarse particulate matter, and what they mean by coarse is particulate matter between the size ranges of PM2.5 and PM10. That's a different terminology than other authors use for the same thing. But they note that inhalation of this is associated with the triggering of a rapid increase in blood pressure and heart rate over a 2-hour period among healthy adults. And it goes on. But this is a significant report from a couple of points of view. There's been a tendency in recent times to suppose that only the very small particles in the nanoparticle range have substantial health effects. And although they have greater health effects per unit volume, the particles that these folks are writing about are particles in the size range that are most likely to be generated by a frac sand operation. So I would like to leave you with a copy of this and urge that people take a look at it. A couple of other points. I think reading the document and asking myself, how useful is this as an informative or educational document for local officials? And I'm speaking as someone who's been more or less an observer of festivities at the county and township level in Goodhue County. And I see a lot of shortcomings. For example, acrylamide is mentioned as a possible water pollutant that could result from frac sand mining, but there's no mention of the fact that it's a neurotoxin and a suspected carcinogen. So they're not really telling people what the stakes might be there. Similarly, there is another flocculant which is approximately polydimethylammonium chloride, and it's mentioned that there is no analytical method for this in groundwater. And there's a statement, I believe, on page 62 that when such an analytical method is developed, it should be used. But a reasonable person might say, why would we want to allow a material to be used for which we have no analytical method to use to monitor its presence in groundwater? So it seems to me it would be logical to say that we would consider allowing you to use this stuff after we have some method of keeping track of it. On the matter of diesel engines, I would again like to take issue with the positions taken by the Sand Council people. The document very appropriately notes that newer diesel engines are far cleaner than older ones by orders of magnitude in some cases. And if we're talking about a new industry, and if we're talking about controlling the impacts of that industry so that it doesn't harm public health, it's extremely appropriate to say that newer and cleaner engines should be part of the picture of how that industry is required to operate. There's a section on blasting agents and explosives that doesn't point out and ought to point out that blasting agents are not considered to be explosives. So if you talk about regulating explosives and people think they're doing that, they might finish up and have someone show up and say, well, yes, but according to OSHA, the ammonium nitrate fuel oil that we're going to use isn't an explosive. So I would suggest some clarification of the wording there would be appropriate. And there are many, many other examples I could cite, but I won't because it's getting late in the afternoon. I'll leave you with this thought. I think many people throughout southeastern Minnesota are getting a lesson in how easy it is for industrial and economic arguments to make themselves heard in Minnesota's political system, and how difficult it is for health and quality of life issues to get a comfortable degree of priority. And I think that when all this is done, many, many people are going to be looking at all of you and hoping to be able to say that you were able to rise to the occasion and hear the people on this issue.
Thank you. Drop that right off on the document you wanted to leave. I appreciate it. Right over here in Megan's seat. Thank you. Carol over. And Kelly, we're saving you to last. So. Welcome, Carol. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you all again, and nice to see you for the first time here, as a member need to be. My name is Carol Overland. I'm an attorney. I, however, am not one of those suits that can roll over local governments. Instead, I've had to work on having the weight advantage and instead represent those local governments who are being steamrolled. And I've experienced firsthand the ability and sophistication of local governments in challenging things like nuclear waste, transmission lines. And the thing is that local governments usually don't have the expertise or the resources to be able to challenge these things. And that's why these types of standards and criteria are so important. And to try to just run down these really quick, because I know you're out of time and you want to get out of here. First, regarding diesel, now I did spend 12 years in a truck before.
I don't really want to get out of here, just the first part. We're running close to out of time.
Yeah, that's true. My experience in a truck and experience in hiring trucks is you can control the specifications of the trucks. So if you want new trucks on the job or trucks that meet certain standards, that's a contractual issue. They do it all the time. So that's not really much of an issue. I think it would be very useful to have in these in the Goodhue County ordinance, the map showing the 1,000-foot setback from public waters. That map is important. But that map hasn't been like publicly released. I've been trying to get a copy of it, and we can. It would be very important, very useful to local governments to see what the impact of such a restriction would be. Number three, there was some talk about the EIS and local governments' use of this tool. And again, most governments don't have the resources to do that. I was witness to on a project I worked on a county where they took the application, cut and pasted it, and then put a new heading on it and called it the Environmental Impact Statement. So there's some real problems there, and these standards and criteria could help local governments do a better job and maybe do a better EIS with some awareness of what kinds of things can be done. There's been some talk about rulemaking, and as Mr. Mueller, who I tend to usually agree with, but he noted that waving existing permits around, saying, well, there's nothing in here, so we don't need it in the standards and criteria. No, that's not a good argument. It's not valid, because this is just more than just an example of why local governments need these local standards and criteria and have the option of adopting them. That standards should support current and future rules, well, that can be a problem. We have a rulemaking process going on, but part of the governor's agenda is streamlining and cutting public participation in that and limiting the ability of people to comment when it's happening. And that's why it's important, if it's not, doesn't get into the rules, then the local governments will really need the ability to select from standards and criteria that could help them do what it is that they want to do. And as Keith Fossum had noted, local governments can do stricter rules. They can have stricter ordinances. We do have local control in Minnesota, and it's very important that local governments understand that, get support for it, and that's what these standards and criteria could do. Again, they're better than they were, but again, I don't think it's ready for prime time. But, so I urge you to show them what is possible, give them that range, and be stronger in your recommendations. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. Kelly.
You know, if you have time for one more after me, that'd be great. Otherwise, I'd like to cede my time to Mr. Lencheski of Trout Unlimited.
Sure.
Would you?
Sure. Hello.
Hello.
Good to see you.
Yeah, I do have a handout. I'm not sure if it's appropriate. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. My name is John Lencheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited. Not sure which one is live. I'll be very brief. These comments are comments I submitted in January. In between the last two drafts, it seems like our comments don't really seem to make it into the document. I'm getting pretty frustrated. There's a lot of great work in this document, but in the area of water quantity and quality, this document hasn't changed in 3 months, and it is still quite inadequate. The document now acknowledges that, you know, 14 of 16 or 50 of 16, you know, LGUs consulted are just going to rely on whatever the agencies say and rely on the existing DNR permitting system. And this is important because we have some gaps here. There are some gaps in the DNR permitting program, and the document doesn't really acknowledge those and offer setbacks. Model setbacks is what you're required to provide. So model setbacks from trout streams, all trout streams, not just a subset, and that's not in the document. Still, I pointed this out a few times. The other woman who spoke was correct. The document misstates what the law says. The law only covers trout streams. Doesn't cover Class 2A waters, doesn't cover springs, doesn't cover perennial tributaries, and that needs to be corrected and the standard should be offered. So we're looking for that model standard, the same one the DNR supported last spring, which is a flat-out ban within a mile of all these features. So that's an important omission we'd like to see corrected. And then the other two are very troubling. There's still no vertical setback from the water table. And again, my comments are only addressing southeastern Minnesota. I'm not, you know, opining about, you know, what should be done in the Minnesota River Valley. But in the southeast, with this world-class trout fishery, it's very important to protect our water quantity and quality. And so, again, DNR supported a vertical setback. I mean, you can quibble whether that should be 25 feet above the water table or 10 or 50. But the fact is we should offer a model setback from the water table. It should say, at least say in this area, the model is stay out of it, stay above the water table. And that's at a minimum. It should be in there. And I suspect, again, probably undue reliance by the agency staff putting this together. They have a permitting program, and I think there's a natural tendency to think, well, we've got the permit, we've got it covered, so there's really no need there. So again, we'd like to see this omission corrected. And then thirdly, I've raised this a couple times, there's still no setback from sinkholes. So our groundwater recharge areas, we still don't have any setback suggestion for how to protect the groundwater recharge areas from the placement of a mine. So again, you know, three kind of serious omissions. Hope you'll consider those. So,
thank you very much, John. Kelly, I said you'd have the last word, so can you do it in a couple of minutes?
I sure can.
All right.
I just have a couple of things to mention. First of all, I would like to thank you very much. Your process has been a very, very good one. You've been very accountable to the public. You have listened. You have been transparent. And you've made everything available to anyone who would want to see it.
Well, that's a good point to end on, right?
that is commendable. And it's not seen all that often in government. So thank you. I have the great pleasure of serving on the Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel. And I must say that your staff is also outrageously good. I had the opportunity to listen to Jeff Hedman when he spoke about air quality, and he's superb. There wasn't a question that he could not answer, and believe me, we hammered him for, I don't know, an hour, was it, Jeff?
Three and a half.
Oh, 3.5 to him, an hour to me. So just awesome job, staff, on this document.
Their heads are swelling over there, and they're going to be wanting raises. You know what you're doing.
They probably deserve them, but okay. Couple of things. I just heard the sand mining folks say that once the sand is processed, that it does not have the fines, so it no longer poses the risk of silicosis. I question that because the visibility of the silica dust issue was raised at fracking sites. NIOSH and OSHA issued a hazard alert 2 years ago, I think in July, and presumably that sand they're using at the fracking site is already clean. So I would have to say that would lead me to believe that clean sand still poses a risk. Secondly, if there's one drawback of this document, it is, and I'll just echo what a couple of other people have mentioned, it is that a ban is not acknowledged. There is a spectrum of regulation, from basically no regulation at the local level to a prohibition of a land use that is found incompatible with the economic and land use activities in the region. And listening to Mr. Peter Larson from the sand industry acknowledge that prohibiting this land use is one of the things that a local government can do, makes me think that should be at least listed in this document as one of the options for local government. Thank you again for the process, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much, Kelly, and thanks to all of you for taking the time to participate. Obviously, there are still strong opinions regarding the draft document. I would sense that many of them probably could be addressed through the process that we have available, which is the EQB website. Some of them, I think, can be addressed through that process. It's been a long process. I compliment again the staff for the hard work that you've put into this. My sense is that everyone won't be happy at the end of the day, but you know, that's the way we're going to sort of move ahead with this whole process. So comments from members of the board. Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief one with respect to what is meant by a designated trout stream. And the statute references designated trout streams, but you have to look at the rule to see what a trout stream actually is in terms of DNR designation. This is in Minnesota Rule 62-64.0050. A designated trout stream is a stream and portions of streams and their tributaries within the section specified by a commissioner. So when you look at the rule, there's a listing, and it clarifies by section, by a 40-acre section, what is included as a trout stream. So it includes the trout stream proper, it includes tributaries, which are the class 2A, it includes tributaries that could be fens or springs to the extent they are tributary to the stream. So it is broader than just the mainstream of the trout stream. And so we will look at that broader definition in terms of identifying the places where DNR permit is required. And that's why there's the difference between what it says in the model standards and what people see in the statute.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Other comments or questions?
Kristen? I would like to know, Mr. Chair, noting the persistence of concern about the full range of local government options, including canning. And I want to say I really appreciate Dr. Nelson's suggestion that this could be addressed not necessarily in this document, but on the ordinance website. And you know, I suspect that doesn't take a motion of the EQB board, but is something that could be practically considered. And I think a very effective place for it. So I want to advocate for that.
Yeah, the process doesn't necessarily end with this document, certainly, and so it's ongoing. And I appreciate that, your comments regarding that. Other issues, comments, questions, fixes?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Stein.
Hearing the concerns over enclosing processing equipment, I want to acknowledge the best practice in the industry, which is to enclose operations, and that it is advised and recommended and strongly evaluated by every engineer I've ever met, enclosure before decisions are made on the ultimate design of a processing facility. I think the point that I take from the testimony today is that the industry representatives are seeking recognition that enclosure is not mandatory in every circumstance, but that in every circumstance it should be evaluated. And so I want to offer a few minor tweaks to the document, and at the risk of editing in public, I'm going to do this as quickly as I can, and I think there are a few. On page 35. In the bottom paragraph under the heading processing,
insert the word in closing before the first word for all. So after the sandstone has been mined, insert the word in closing. All subsequent processing steps should be, strike the word enclosed and insert evaluated. So that after the sandstone, the sentence would read, after the sandstone has been mined, comma, in closing all subsequent processing steps should be evaluated, period. The next sentence remains as written. The third sentence of that paragraph then be amended to read, all emissions from, strike the word the, insert the word any. So that sentence would then read, all emissions from any enclosed processes should be ducted to control equipment designed to mitigate particulate matter emissions. Further then on page 39, under the very last paragraph under the heading temporary storage, on the bottom line of that page, after the word rather, insert evaluating where, and then on the top of page 40, strike everything from and to the end of the first, to the end of that sentence that ends with above, and insert is recommended. So the sentence then reads, storage piles that are intended to be used at the facility on a recurring basis are not considered temporary storage, semicolon. Rather, comma, evaluating where these piles should be enclosed is recommended. That's my those are my amendments.
You're moving that as an amendment to the document?
I am.
Is there a second to the motion? There is a second to the motion. Is there further discussion? Related to the motion on the table. I think it's a good move and that will fix up some of the issues that were addressed here earlier, so I certainly would support that. You've heard the motion. There is a second. There is further discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. We're on the document then, with as amended. There is a motion. Given the fact that it was amended, I guess I would ask that we let's see.
Vote as amended.
As amended. All right. Are you ready to vote? If so, I would ask Will to call the roll.
Chairman Fredrickson.
Yes.
Ms. Ivy Tolleson?
Yes.
Ms. Gehring?
Yes.
Commissioner Lambert?
Yes.
Commissioner Napstad?
Yes.
Commissioner Rothman?
Yes.
Mr. Saxon?
Yes.
Commissioner Linkstein?
Yes.
Commissioner Zelli?
Yes.
The document is approved, and I want to thank each and every one of you for, again, taking the time to participate in this process. It's been a long process, but nonetheless a good process, and keep tuned in and keep engaged. With that, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Is there a second? There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. The meeting is adjourned. You're going to go with Charlie? Okay, so we
can. Yeah, well, you guys can stop.
All right.
Good.
I do not have the copy of what Peter Larson gave. Okay, good.
I've got it recorded, Dave.
Oh, dear.